on some of their nameplates that they wanted to bring. I'm not sure whether it is on the same bill or something else. And one of the things that we impressed upon to DSA was, because some of the infrastructure rollout activities that they are funding, and the fact that they will no longer be dealing with feasibility studies and other than funding, all those things. Can they bounce some of these amendments which are also the target away? Did they change them in confidence on what is going to be an alternative for municipalities to still access grant funding that cannot use them to do feasibility and all those things? So I'm just saying, I'm not sure whether this is the same bill that we dealt with the other time, when Sarah only speaks about them being considered to be in the voting system, because there were areas and elements in the proposed amendment of DSA where we thought Sarah had to be on top of the situation in terms of
what's your perspective on the point? What effect do you have?
Was it last week or a week before where we met with DBSA on the agreement? And DBSA was talking about how they're going to expand on their infrastructure rollout in South Africa and in Africa. And the DBSA said one of the lessons they have learned was that they used municipalities were their biggest land. They defeated their funds through disabilities and other things in the form of grants, and they nearly ran bankrupt. Now the amendment they brought was to say, no longer going to deal with grant funding or disabilities and whatever. Treasury is going to have this in another whatever system. I want this to look at this. You remember, I even proposed to them to say, DSA, because my spouses are getting MIGs and they are concerned on 3-year basis, assist them to bring development forward by using what is guaranteed and bring and fund them now, and then they can then repay you over time. And they said already they are using that. In fact, it is still the same bill, by the way, on infrastructure. And that's when we then said some of them no longer having going to have feasibility studies and grant funding from their side because they want to expand into Africa and other things and BRICS related things and so on. So municipalities are going to be the hardest thing. And that's where we even said, is Sarga aware of these things and how do you take Sarga on board on some of the things? Unfortunately, I can't talk to the specifics, but I thought they must be alive to this and follow it so that they can be
able to look at that. Not your main report.
Chair, the discussion that he gave the reference to, I think it was when we discussed the business plan, the business plan, and their annual performance plan, and their new focus. And so forth. However, there is merit to what she is saying in as far as the bill is concerned. It has seen that we are now considering this, the amendments to this bill. Though obviously there was only one amendment, and you are correct, there was only one amendment and we are going to stick to that amendment. But now the FARCA is coming with a new amendment over and above what we have considered. Obviously, it will have to go to the House. And we follow the normal procedures because it makes sense for SARGA to be represented. In fact, from the discussions that we had, it was very clear that SARGA ought to be represented as an organization, as a representative body of municipalities in DBSA, so that they can, whenever they are considering strategic change in their direction or whatever, they need to bring the municipalities on board their main side.
Okay, so we were in the meeting with the DSA and then soon we have some sort of report. So if there's anything relevant to the process in ourselves, we will consider it that it's not. and but I'll find it very curious with regard to the progress made by the GDSA in terms of financing and possibly shift the financing from the metros to the smaller municipalities. Now, if my memory serves me right, in the past we thought that would be the case of the GDSA in terms of their loan book. I think that was the debate in the last session. But from the point of view from SALGA, it would be very helpful if we could perhaps also have some indication as to the value that the GDSA really adds, especially to the smaller municipalities in terms of financing those projects. And the chair has spoken about the report. I would like to be that formal in requesting a report. But certainly from SALGA's point of view, the importance of the GDSA, your views, how important is it, the progress has been made, and how efficient and effective were the GDSA, that would be very useful information for this.
Thank you. Chairperson, I think I've indicated that 50% of the work done at municipalities, we work with GDSA fund us, and it will be therefore very helpful if we sit together, see things, and really provide with the expertise that we have in local government. And they are really helping us of now. We are working together. But I think we need to formalize the structure where we sit in, and hence the request now on this one. But we are working together. It is just so informal. We must formalize it. Thanks.
Okay, thank you very much. Any other comments? Who got the report? I don't know what happened. That's why David is saying it's relevant to our goal, we provide it. If it isn't, then it's any size, any case of the world. Having said that, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Okay, over there to the FSC.
Sorry, Chair, just to say that I know you're not responsible for finance and what about the finances. We weren't cut down anyway, so we thought we'd join your committee. We didn't incur the cost that the government spent 10
cents. That struck me, actually. In fact, I was going to ring you up after 10 cents, one person. When I read your bill, I thought, what is it you said? Not so controversial. Except for the DA when they're wonky. Everybody else is going crazy. DA, yes, well, you can't expect much from that. But for the majority, you don't know how to do it. So I just wanted to see if you had come.
But I also needed to see the
future. Yeah, that was about 2:11 last night. And I thought, you know, I think 2:11 is rather late for, you know, your young people. So I had not told you. But it's a very impressive last delegation. Right.
Because
the thing
is,
I think we also want somebody, especially with Zelda, quite a number of things. One at hand, which me and Officer was in the structure. Remember, they I think on our program, let's have a session with Zelda on some of the things.
Yeah.
Because it will need to be able to come into the
system. I hope the music systems is acknowledging the issues the members want to on the program. Because then we have it all up and then decide what is doable and what is not. Right, I would say that I want to talk to you, we're talking about 40 minutes late. Especially because the GDA is going to be reaching in S35. I went to S35A. But now here we are with the MFC. I just want to share with you that, we considered in our budget review report that the budget of the MFC is going down. And we raised this question about how seriously is the MFC taken by the National Treasury Government and the all three tiers of government, Parliament, the legislators, and the like. And we found that there needs to be some sort of capital going on there. With you being heavily involved, it should involve all the things that I mentioned, maybe
No, thank you. Thank you, Chairperson. And let me say I welcome the steps that you have taken in actually opening this discussion. I think from my side, I must say that, having been acting as the chairman, CEO, and the deputy chairman of the commission for the past 4 years, it hasn't been a very easy. It hasn't been a very easy. So in spite of my hope, it's not been that easy. So it's been quite a difficult challenge. But it would be that it is late.
Will you introduce your team?
Yes, I will do that. I have with myself brought Commissioner Nico Steiser. I am hoping that one of the most recent appointments to the Commission, Professor Mayende, will be joining us. I think he flew from Cape Town, from Port Elizabeth this morning, and he was supposed to land at 9:40. So I'm hoping that he will be joining us in the course of this discussion. And then I have members of the Secretariat on my right. It's Sasha Peters. She is based in our Cape Town office and responsible for our national budget analysis. At the back there is our Commission Secretary. Her name is Antia Maharaj Madova. And then I have on my left Dr. Ramos Mabuku, who is the Research Director for the Commission. My name is Bongani Khumalo. Normally I'm supposed to be the Deputy Chairman of the Commission. I'm the Acting Chairman and also the Acting Chief Executive Officer.
Nico, for the
way? Nico is one of the Commissioners, one of the outside Commissioners of the Commission. Let me say, I think we must all be aware that the Commission is established in terms of the Constitution, Section 220, as an independent body. It must function in terms of an Act of Parliament, which is the Financial and Fiscal Commission Act, 1997, amended in 2003. It is supposed to make recommendations and research in Chapter 13 of the Constitution, or in national legislation to parliament, provincial legislatures, and organized local governments and any other organ of state as determined by national legislation. Now, in terms of the composition of the commission, it comprises 9 persons, which is the chairperson and deputy chairperson. At the moment, we only have a deputy chairperson who is the acting chairperson of the commission in terms of the, and the act in terms of the Financial and Fiscal Commission Act, which says if there is no substantive chairperson, then the deputy chairperson becomes the chairperson of the commission or acts as the chairperson. 3 persons appointed after consultation of provincial premiers from a list compiled in accordance with the process prescribed by national legislation. Now, at the moment, we've got 8 commissioners. So the only vacancy that now exists since last week, when the president appointed the commissioners, is that of the chairperson of the commission. That's the only vacancy that remains. So now the commission is almost like fully constituted. One problem, chairperson, that I should actually raise with you is that we have failed to actually comply with the gender requirements. We had 3 female commissioners whose terms expired at the end of June. Now, I did raise that particular matter with the National Treasury, the Minister, that when we appoint, we need to appoint female commissioners, because otherwise we're going back to where we were almost 10 years ago. So we now back to 1 female commissioner out of those 9, which is a concern of the commission is around the sustainability of a credible intergovernmental fiscal relations system. I think what is important, Jefferson, that I must raise is the issue where certain executive decisions or changes in legislation that have got intergovernmental financial and fiscal implications have been taken in the past, actually, without consulting the Financial Fiscal Commission. I think it speaks to the issue that you raised about whether there is any seriousness in dealing with the Commission on some of these issues. So we have picked up some of these issues. Sometimes we pick them up because somebody comes back and says, no, we've got an abandoned mandate. And then we say, but how did that happen? So this decision did not comply with the law, so why are you providing that kind of service? It's not your responsibility. It does not have any force in law in terms of the Financial Fiscal Commission. So these things have happened. We have sensitized Parliament over the past 4 or 5 years, and I think there's now that issue, that awareness has been created with the primary stakeholders, that we need to actually go through those processes, and hopefully going forward these things will be reduced. I must say that the most recent one, which we are keeping an eye on, although I haven't actually received any formal notification, was a decision that was taken to assign the housing function to local government, to the cities in particular, as part of the accreditation process. Now what we are hearing is that that might actually be reversed. But the problem is that the Division of Revenue Act, who was already passed with that in mind, that is, so the allocations were made to local government. Some of these municipalities have already invested money in actually creating the relevant capacity to receive that function, and if we then reverse it, which means we might actually have to stop the grant that was made for capacity. It's a whole big issue. So we haven't received any formal notification of that, but my secretariat has had discussion with the National Treasury around this particular matter, and we are awaiting formal communication around that. I might as well say that there's quite a number of other branches that are shifting either from province to national or from national to including better education and training, which we actually trying to deal with at this particular point in time that we need to keep an eye on. I've listed some stakeholders that we work with at the minute. We just move on to the role that we play in the economy. We have to put it into three pillars, providing advice to government on the division of revenue and developmental impact and sustainable intergovernmental fiscal relations. So I think when one looks at the issues around the division of revenue, those were the primary issues maybe the first 10 years of the system, designing the relevant transfer formulas and setting up the relevant institutions to deal with this particular matter. But I think after 10 years of that, and basically establishing the transparency in the way in which resources are actually allocated between and among the spheres of government, we think that those type of first generation issues have been fairly addressed. Obviously, with time, we've got to be changing these things, adjusting to so that it's aligned with the environment existing at that particular point in time. And what has become significantly more important are the second generation type of issues that basically now relate to the impact of those allocations. What impact have they made? We've been through two cycles of an economic cycle. So we've been up there enjoying huge surpluses, and we probably try to manage those surpluses very well because they managed to cushion us when the global economic crisis set in. But going forward, because of the time that it has taken to actually get out of that global economic crisis, we've realized that with probably a false sense of plenty, we have not actually been tracking manufacturing going. So those are the kinds of issues that I pose, like a generation type of issue that basically say you allocate the money, you must now look at what impact has this money made. And those are the issues that we are actually now very much concerned with. We're basically extending to look at the developmental impact, to focus on issues of poverty, which is a key challenge facing South Africa, linked to the level of unemployment and the unequal distribution of income. And that is something that the Commission is moving quite rigorously into. We're also trying to build a core group of people that actually work on this intergovernmental fiscal relations system. I think this system started in 1994. Universities in South Africa were still teaching public finance in the old sense. Over the last few years, we've seen like quite a number of universities now bringing into the forefront issues that deal with fiscal decentralization, the challenges related to that, which is basically an area that we have felt that needs to be rooted, and we need to develop a core group of people that can actually work on these particular types of issues. So it's like creating human capital in the type of public finance system that we are aiming at. Now, this little chart here basically tells us what we have done and how we have responded to the Money Bill Amendment Procedure and Related Measures Act. Now, like I say, the Commission's recommendations are grounded in Chapter 13, which I sometimes refer to as the fiscal constitution of the country. So there's quite a number of areas there that we need to deal with. But now part of that now links to this Money Bill Amendment Procedure and Related Matters Act, which has brought to the fore the Commission's interest in the fiscal framework. Now, we focus on the fiscal framework. Primarily, our interest is towards the medium-term budget policy statement, so that we are able to advise Parliament where we did what we said in May when we submitted our recommendations, what comes out of the medium-term budget policy statement, and how it actually came out when you get to the tabling of the budget. So our very key interest is around the medium-term budget policy statement, around this Money Bill Amendment Procedure and Related Matters. So we decided to combine, Chairperson, in our submission, issues that deal with the fiscal framework and the macroeconomic outlook, together with issues that deal with the division of revenue. And so the submission that we tabled in May contains all of these issues. Now, in terms of the Intergovernmental Fiscal Relations Act, the Minister of Finance must respond to recommendations on the division of revenue. So the discussion that we have been having, that we have been having with the former Minister of Finance, who is now the Minister of Corporate Governance and Traditional Affairs, was how does he respond to issues that are outside of the division of revenue process, but are still part of the Commission's mandate, because the Commission's mandate does not end on the division of revenue alone. It also includes any other financial and fiscal measures, and those are matters that the Commission decides on. And so the response of the Minister of Finance over the past 2 years has been focused only on those issues raised by the Commission relating to the division of revenue. And on the other matters, he has actually intended to have a discussion with the Commission. So we submitted something to him as to why we thought it was important that he looked at the project. And not isolate, because the division of revenue matters in one way or another have to do with what the fiscal framework looks like. So you can't separate those types of issues. That was our point, but we understood his point, but we never got to sit as a commission with him to discuss that in that way. So my view and with the commission was that we need to leave this with Parliament, and Parliament must then have a conversation with the Minister of Finance around how these issues must be treated. So I'm ready once again with your committee now, like I did with the previous. summarize the direction in which the Financial and Fiscal Commission wants to move, starting with, as I say, looking at the impacts, value for money, and particularly what we are doing for the poor and the vulnerable, and making recommendations around those particular issues, and then looking at issues around improving sustainability going forward. I think in our submission that we tabled in May, and I'm not sure when we're going to have that conversation with the committee around that submission, one of the key issues that we raised there was the issue of balancing the social program expectations and demands, which sometimes manifest themselves in service delivery projects and all of that, with the economy's own performance and direction that it's going. So I think the Minister of Finance did mention that in the budget report about some revisions downward and where we are going. And that brings to the fore the issue of debt and the sustainability of debt. So we're looking at those issues. But in terms of the work that we're doing, Chairperson, we've added a couple of other things that the government needs to take into account when we talk about issues of sustainability. So there are issues around gender, the environment, and also energy. The issues around poverty and inequality, I must say that we just completed a study together with the University of Cape Town, the University of Fort Hare, and the University of Venda, around the issues of vulnerability in two rural provinces, the Eastern Cape and Limpopo. So that report will probably be finalized, because we report to you, so we will actually table that report with you in the next month or so. We should be done with that. That slide basically just provides some of the kinds of things that we do and that we have done in the past 5 years in particular. With that, let me ask Dr. Ramos Mabuku to take you through the issues that you raised relating to the National Development Plan, National Development Plan, and also our work in the next 5 years.
Thank you,
Chair.
Good morning, honorable members. Our work plan for the next 5 years, 2014 to 2019, has been couched within the context of the National Development Plan. It was chosen as a theme for our 5 year strategy. So that is like a mental physical foundation in support of national development. And national development. The National Development Plan, in essence, the vision there is elimination of poverty, zero poverty, and reduction of inequality to 0.6 from around 0.7 by 2030. So it's not a goal for this year or next year, but for 2030 progressively eliminating poverty to zero and reducing inequality. And we've got three pillars in our work plan to make our contribution to the theme of our developmental fiscal relations and support national development plan. Around the first is around the dynamics of the economy and social issues, and that we are hoping will address the equity issues. And the term dynamics, they actually take into account the point that I've just spoken to, that this is not a vision for just this year or next year, but for 2030. In other words, the entire dimension that one needs to take into account. So that's the third pillar that addresses that time issue and the economy and social issue under the pillar of equity issues. The second pillar looks at issues of balance between accumulation and making breakthroughs. And we've also realized that because the our commission years, actually, been established now for 20 years. There's a lot of institutional issues that should not be lost in life to 2030. So a large part of our work will also be on re-emphasizing impact in developing elements for today and causing them to inform the present day issues. The final and third pillar is around the issues of telecom aids, efficiency, effectiveness, and delivering collective goods. So those are the three pillars giving effect to the work plan. Now, looking in on intergovernmental fiscal relations within the National Development Plan, which is when we positioned ourselves for the 5 years. Having gone through the plan, our assessment is that Chapter 13 of the plan is the one which deals most explicitly with the content. Although there are other chapters that have a strong relationship, for example, macroeconomic policy issues covered in Chapter 1, issues around demography, which again are very important for driving change. Come in Chapter 2, issues around economy and employment, Chapter 3, and so on. So although Chapter 13 is one dedicated to capital state issues, there are these other supporting chapters all the way from 1 up to Chapter 15 that is relevant for the issue of intergovernmental fiscal relations in the national development plan that we will be focusing on as part of the work plan. Now, the interface between the development plan transition and the transitional budget plan that we've been working on is where we are hoping to make quite a big impact. What Chapter 13 says is that unevenness is capacity that leads to uneven performance in local, provincial, and national government is the key factor exacerbating poverty and inequality. So the vision is the elimination of poverty and reduction of inequality. Chapter 13 argues that the bottleneck for the bottleneck to address in order to eliminate poverty and inequality is making an impact on that capacity among the three pillars of the government. And the National Planning Commission Diagnostic Report actually refers to intergovernmental relations among the three spheres that are poor, contributing to increasing the cost for poor people and confining them to poverty types. So when one looks at the arguments within Chapter 13, it's in how to unlock the unevenness in capacity among the three spheres and how to sort out the intergovernmental fiscal relations which are poor, again, key to eliminating poverty completely and reducing inequality to the objective. So that's the key argument just addressing for our assessment. Now, the key intergovernmental fiscal relations issues in the National Development Plan comes down now to understanding the context of fiscal decentralization versus issues of centralization. How does one find expenditure for the benefits? In terms of what about issues of instruments for financing sub-national governments among the various instruments that are available? Issues of implementation of the budget and harmonizing and aligning of the support disagreement, however, is in that of the NECOM, that no one says that all those actions are being done by central government. And this is where the cut of the matter of the back of the FSA recommendations come in, that we have agreed on those three issues as the main issues to center the work on, but the visitor doesn't give us guidance on which is particular CA the best place to do any one of those functions. Moving on, the key issues actually can be understood as two main issues for the 2014 to 2019. I'll go into slightly more detail. It's centered around the issue of fiscal decentralization and redistribution. So those are the two key issues, and how financing of those key issues on decentralization and redistribution come together. Well, decentralization is critical for delivery for many arguments, including the core base type argument. Sometimes the national department is too far from where the basic services are actually delivered for it to respond quickly enough to a present problem that is leaking pipe or some such issue. So decentralization can be quite a key critical instrument for delivery. But the question is, how far down do we decentralize? For example, we have issues in education where we've seen some functions within education going down to provinces, and now we're talking about those functions migrating back to national here. So it's not quite clear cut exactly where certain functions are best located. Hospitals, are they placed at provincial level or should the national or even the local scene. So there are many important social services where the turnout is a work plan for the sites, like issue of water, sanitation, and electricity are also issues that are in the work plan. How do we deal with concurrent functions between and within spheres? We are beginning to see a lot of interesting dynamics within that area where there is a huge unprecedented increase in the use of indirect grants, unlike before, when you look at what has been happening in the last 3 years compared to 20 years back. Huge increase in indirect grants, which suggests that the dealing of these issues is an issue which really needs to be looked into in more detail. The issues of timing are also extremely important. One can imagine that it's important how time shifts in the function. Let's say you're shifting education. In education function, you don't know how to shift it when children are going exams for the examination. You want to make the shift so that you have left the first thing that's possible. But there are many other important timing issues within the cycle that are important. Now, coming to redistribution issues, as opposed to the decentralization issues and exactly where functions today. The key issue around redistribution, and again, this now comes to the issue that one can eliminate all poverty and reduce income inequality to the system. That speaks to redistribution. The main issues are around how do you pay for redistribution to poor households? Is that best done through check system and through intergovernmental grants, for instance, that is the best way to pay for the redistribution that is in the vision. Should it be fully
competent.
So what we are saying is those are the issues that we need answers on, and that will be the focus for the 2014 to 2019 year, because they have to speak on our contribution to the national development plan of the next 5 years in the invitation. And then the main areas, the other main areas for intervention that talk to the central aggression and redistribution of it in an indirect fashion is issues around knowledge production sharing, which are important here for the underlying of the overall blockchain addressing of issues around redistribution. Moving on to the next one. This is the logical framework that we have developed for giving effect to our theme of intergovernmental fiscal relations in support of national development. So we've identified the desired national development plan impact for the area, and then we've come up with medium-term outcomes moving where we target for 2014 to 2019, and then we've identified the priority areas for the Commission to focus on in order to make the best on that the desired impact. Then the third column, the fourth column, says why it is a very big concern on measure. And most of the arguments for it being an FSC concern are around the vision of federal units, money bills, the amendment profit as a related measure argument, and the objective that we talked to. And then the final column actually lists the identified project that will be done between 2014 and 2019 to give effect to the national development plan. To the next slide, especially. So throughout those projects, from the FFP lab, we'll be looking at the factors which make a difference in whether and how the goals of the national development plan are achievable. In particular, how should delivery of national development plan evolve in the medium term and towards 2030? In the medium term here, we are defining it as five-year work plan that we are discussing with you today. So for 2014, 2019, and then towards 2030, should the emphasis be on promoting decentralization through capacity building, or should the national government assume major responsibility for meeting the constitutional mandate, and then advising all the time on fiscal intervention dimensions to many of the development? There are other issues outside of the major work plan that I have spoken to, to sensitize the committee on. There are issues of gaining overall fiscal discipline and other issues which are ongoing exercises that the commission works for. Issues around adequacy of transfers to sub-national government, continual refinement and updating of transfer formulas, and work that goes on generally within the commission. Many issues around STEM becoming where we look at capacity challenges vis-à-vis the issues of efficiency, striking balances between national and provincial interests against the observation of increasing indirect grants is an issue that we're looking at quite a lot. And then around issues of value for money as well, we are increasingly getting interested in issues around supply chain management and procurement issues without a prisoner back with available resources for sharing among the 3 years of government. Then we have made partnerships with other like-minded constitutional bodies which have managed in areas that have been bearing on our work. For instance, we have partnered with the commission to look at issues around wastage and line of the wage bill, as long as it delivers a service which is consistent with the volume or size of the wage bill. So the central argument there is for this value for money, the price of the wage bill should correspond to the value that we derive from a large So a large public service that delivers a large service to become something that the Commission will be saying very sorry for money, but a large public sector waste that delivers very little is something where there is no value for money being derived. So in looking more closely into the value that are derived from establishment, and that is being done in collaboration with the Public Service Commission and operating arrangement and understanding that we have and then around issues of food security in rice project. We had a collaboration with the Human Rights Commission around the issues of food, where we are focusing a lot more on the financial aspect to food security, and the Human Rights Commission focusing on the issue of food security as a right. Within those energies are going to prove quite useful to a fuller understanding of issues around food security. Then the last part, this is an announcement, and the chairperson has spoken to you, Chair, around the intergovernmental fiscal relations conference that will be happening from the 11th to the 2nd of August. It's an international conference that commemorates 20 years of South Africa's intergovernmental fiscal relations with people giving different perspectives on many angles, which the invitation is also being extended to committee members who is present here to share some of our relations and
this is the first time that I'm meeting in this study.
just thank the AFC for their presentation. There are just a few issues that I would like them to clarify to us. The SLCO slash acting chairperson spoke about there being no credible intergovernmental discrimination system. And I wanted to know also who do we expect to actually establish that system if FFC is not going to take that role itself of actually putting something together, making sure that you come up with a credible fiscal, intergovernmental fiscal relation system. And the second thing that I also wanted to check is because I really believe that the FFC has a very big role, but for some strange reason, I don't know whether the FFC underplays its own role and what it can actually contribute. I'm not sure what might be the problem, underlying problem. The reason why I'm raising this is because you are also, you've presented to the relationship that you've established with the Public Service Commission, especially looking at the negative knock-on effect of corruption and on the issues of fiscal relations or whatever and so forth, and how that undermines service delivery. But there was also something else that I wanted to check with you, whether you have considered looking at this. We've had an opportunity of engaging with SARS, and you know, if you look at the kind of growth that SARS has been able, despite the economy or economy contracting and so forth, and the challenges with transfer pricing or illicit trade and what have you, but if you look at the personal income tax, it's been going up, and there is something that SARS is doing right. Have we as commissioners of the system, have we as the Finance and Fiscal Commission, engaged with the commission of the SARS to check what is working? Is there a possibility of us establishing an entity that is independent, a municipal entity that is independent, that would be doing the collection on behalf of the municipality? Because the national and provincial government, they have SARS that is doing the collections for them. And in a local level, you have municipalities, they are responsible for service delivery, they are responsible for collections, and so forth and so forth. And if you look at their debt book, it is growing on a daily basis. And just this morning, we saw what ESCOM was saying about municipalities that not being able to pay even ESCOM and so forth. Unless you have a very strong vehicle. And I say I'm locating that within an effective and credible fiscal relations you know, system. I'm just trying to check if you have you considered those factors, because they are going to be very important in actually assisting municipalities to become more efficient. And also to make sure that even as we discuss the decentralization issues and so forth, you can't discuss that unless you have fixed this problem. Without money, you can devolve this money, it should simply not be accounted for. We had a target 2014, we are still, we are nowhere, the 2014 audit, we are nowhere close to that. Okay. Now, finally, I wanted to check as well whether we have a structured relationship with the demarcation board. And I will tell you why the demarcation board is very important. That's because the demarcation board, because I had a stint as a member of the board. One of the things that I was looking at was that, you know, sometimes the way we demarcate, we really don't take issues, seriously issues of financial viability into account, and those type of issues. Now, I wanted to know whether we have a structured relationship with the demarcation board, as well as that SA. Because that SA, I will tell you, a lot of municipalities, and I'm sure you would know that, Chair. I'm talking about not two chairs, I'm talking about the acting chair. The acting chair of the commission. I know that you would probably be aware that most municipalities, if you look at most municipalities, especially your small municipalities, especially those that are at the border, they are really, really complaining that whatever the outcomes, and we believe in the official steps, I'm not saying we don't believe in them, but there are factors that sometimes we don't take into account, especially with your cross, with your border municipalities. They have other pressures on their services, municipal services. Like we find that people are coming across and they are using abolitional facilities and you complain that they are not being maintained. But what they, the revenue, the division of revenue, has not taken those factors into account. They are only relying on these statistics that are here. And now that is also very important for you to establish that structured relationship. Is there a structured relationship with these two primary institutions that have a bearing on your work as a finance and fiscal commission? Thank you,
Chair. I think you also give the commission that you can think here in the country is sort of a cross for you. I think just taking further the issue that Honorable Makosi also picked up on the division of the menu, especially around smaller municipalities. We are 20 years into democracy, and I thought the FFC would also, looking at what their strategic focus is going to be, issues around redistribution and decentralization. That's what they're talking about. And what then comes into mind is that there are small municipalities, most of which are predominantly rural, with no revenue base. And we can't keep on saying, because they don't have any revenue base, therefore they will always receive breadcrumbs, for lack of a better way. And I had thought, if you look at and you analyze those municipalities, deeply rural, with no or very minimal level of basic infrastructure, and you look at the millennium development goals that we have set ourselves on, we may be affected in reaching some of those goals because of their situation in those municipalities. And because SSC is there to analyze at what Jora is doing and how it is being distributed and all those things, and the good thing that they are now going to focus on is the impact of some of those things. Can't we now start to look at the 20 years in democracy, what Dora was able to achieve, where are we in municipalities, especially rural provinces, what this redistribution and decentralization must look at, given some of the situations in those years. And I think this is something that we now have to look at. Shall we focus in getting examples from what the acting chair was saying on other financial methods that they are going to focus on with the minister beyond Zora, so that we also start to look at and see maybe there may be cabinet interventions that can assist us in dealing with some of the things. The other issue, Chair, if you look at that program of key issues, the area of FFC interventions in the NDP from 2014 to 2019, that program that they are going to look at, there's somewhere where they are talking about division of revenue, growing revenue for distribution and other related areas. And I think Comrade Makosi touched it a bit, which I think is another avenue that the FFC can also look at. given the number of days that is prescribed in municipalities, as opposed to that being collected by the municipalities. But I was also thinking that in the SRC that are looking at growing revenue for distribution, is the SRC also saying that there are other areas where DORA is underperforming for them to be able to get more money to be able to redistribute and other things? And if there are those areas, which areas are they? So that we can also look at that as well. There's also, on a lighter note, Chair, and please pardon me for my ignorance. You know, the Territorial Commission, I think it's on page 3. There's a last bullet there that says, appointments may not exceed 5 years. And saying, but commissioners are eligible for reappointment. I'm not sure if I understand that bullet correctly. It qualifies the commissioners for reappointment. But the first sentence, who is it talking to? If it's English, because it's not my mother tongue.
I think our lecture starts with the firstly the numbers issue, Chairperson, which we're talking about. I think I'm the only person in this room whose Tsonga language is also called English. That's how we say Tanganishimu. So I'm fine actually talking English, but it's Tanganishimu. Let me then go back to measures which were presented to us here. Chairperson, I think the CEO. I think it's a good position. On your own. And it's been happening for a couple of years. Chairperson, I think the question is to address it's quite a serious matter, even if you know we keep on saying there's a 3-in-1 and all that. So if the minister is addressing it, that is something we should also be addressed. On page 5, let's start with page 4. On before there is a lower flag. There's a matter here which I think is the third major section, which says imparting knowledge through training to post staff working on the IGFR. I would like to find out, taking into consideration a question which was asked by Honorable P. If that training is actually happening, means there's now a core group of people that are well trained, that are financial fully, that are able to identify matters and actually deal with them. How long is this training been going on? And how much of it are we actually benefiting from? Unless it is something that will be starting anew, then one would say that probably something that is new. But then there is this core, and if the core is there, where is this core group deployed? Where are they deployed? So that they are strategically based and they are able to actually catch matters before they actually get out of hand. Secondly, there's that letter on page 5, the lower slide as well, where the CEO actually mentioned an area where they had discussions with Minister Pravin, the former Minister Pravin Kudan. I think your person there as well, we will need an input from that, because we were just informed about it just like it, and it sounded quite serious. So we need the information to be given to the committee so that we get an understanding of how far that discussion did go. I would then like to go to page 9, the upper slide. Page 9, the upper slide, there's this elimination of poverty, reduction of inequality, which is something that is very critical to us as a country, because we are aware that in order to address the issues of imbalances, we need to focus ahead on these issues. I'm saying to myself, if I were to take this document to my people in Chawezi, yeah, so it, how much is 0.6? How much is this 0.6? Inequality to 0.6. What actually influences us? Because that is quite important. What influences us to work towards, we're aware that we've got certain figures that might assist us to actually think that we are looking at this, because there's so much of figures, and then we are waiting for 0.4, 0.6. Just to figure, what are we talking about? And then I would like to thank the presenter, especially for number 10, page 10, the top slide, where here the interface between developmental planning, training, and everything else, those three slides, those three points, they are so important to us. Because, you know, we need to ensure that the interface is made with unevenness in capacities addressed and the NPC diagnosis. I like the issue of the diagnosis of the intergovernmental relations among the three spheres of government with APCO. Now, I would also like to make a request. Can we get more information on this, even if it's fair to our chairperson, so that we get an understanding of exactly what those points mean, because they are very, very important to me. There's also a few questions here, chairperson, which are asked. I think those questions are on page 12. Page 12, the cost flat. There's questions there, how do we pay for the distribution, the redistribution, the limited use of cross-subsidization, and I look at Honorable Buck saying it's a question. or a statement. I think there is where, let us say, I think that's the representation that was made by the gentleman next to the CEO. Who actually has to answer those questions? Who has to answer those questions? Because these are critical questions and they need to be answered. And I expect it, yourself to actually guide us as to most of these issues, because a lot of them have been researched, a lot of them have been done, not just to give them a question for us to present here on paper. Lastly, to address the issue of the Human Rights Commission as well as the issue of the Public Service Commission. The Public Service Commission has done a lot of research over years, was interacted with them in government for many years. And most of these issues, like some of the issues which you have addressed in the other slides, on poverty, on corruption, on the use of consultants, on all that type of things, they've done research on that. We really hope that through your interaction, you'll also be able to source that type of information from them and ensure that you enhance your documentation so that it actually shows that you don't only in collaboration with the Public Service Commission look at legal areas, look at critical measures which they have done, which will assist you. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Chair. There's an interesting illustration of the Gini coefficient, which is almost close to 0.7, I think, there's an indication. When we drive up William Street, those of us that go late at night, and you drive up there past the Ferrari place, and you take a picture there of the Ferraris and the other cars and the homeless people sleeping there. And whenever I drive past there, I think there's a picture of the Gini coefficient of inequality. So I think that is something quite interesting. But, Chair, thank you. We've had some very robust discussions in the past with the previous parliament. I mean, one particular, I think it was about 5 years ago, about the value added by the FSC. We appreciate that it's a constitutional mandated body. But I must say, looking at this and tying in with the NDP, I personally see a lot of growth in what you intend doing and aligning with NDP and a lot of value. It's not that you haven't added value in the past, but it's almost like a Cinderella that I don't think there's parliamentarians have appreciated the full ability, but there is obviously there was space to improve. And when I looked at structure, in as much as the acting position that needs to be filled, and you've been hampered by a large degree as well with the lack of the filling of posts. But I just wanted to touch on one or two things. A lot of my colleagues have touched on some of the issues that are very helpful. I thought in particular the local government issue was very helpful, that on to assist in capacity to collect revenue. But you mentioned something that is quite a concern, and that is the functions that are shifting, where national provincial ministers have not consulted with you, and they are intending to shift those functions. Chair, that's very serious. But that's illegal, basically. We need, as a committee, to have some resolution that we would draw attention to this. I don't know if national provincial ministers are unaware of this, but just think, if those functions are moved and they are contested, you might find some body that is unhappy, and they contest and they say that you never ever consulted with the MC, that's illegal. So we might want to consider a committee reference in a report that arises from this discussion, just to highlight that for the knowledge of the executive. Chair, then I just wanted to touch on the last slide where you've got the second last slide and the last slide, the economics of corruption, supply chain management and procurement. It's obviously a massive, massive issue that you are focusing on, and it has the attention of everyone, National Treasury, everyone, how to deal with corruption, because obviously in the Justice Committee, in response to my question to the Special Investigating Unit, the extent of corruption at that stage is 30 billion rand per year, state procurement, a rough estimate. If one can successfully start recovering that amount and address that, and I see you do allude to supply chain management and the National Treasury is doing work there with the Chief Procurement Officer. But how does one take this, and is this memorandum of understanding? Are you eventually taking some effective steps to assist? How are you going to start dealing with that? Because obviously there's a lot of money that can be collected, but there's also stuff to prevent, to be prevented in that area. And then we all know, we mentioned the issue relating to the wage law. You know,
leverage into that, and it's highlighted on your webpage, moderating provincial wage bill, both and enhancing productivity. And you said you're not commenting on the size of the wage bill, but I think that's fundamental as well. We know that there's going to be negotiations at the end of this year, and the medium-term budget is premised on a certain increase, and if that increase comes in higher, it obviously has implications for debt going forward. So I'd like you to obviously look into the implications on the intergovernmental fiscal relations, particularly national-provincial, of the wage bill negotiations that are going to take place. And of course, you link it to productivity, which is a key element as well, which we welcome. So I think, Chair, from our side, those are just a few comments. Thank you.
Can you give a point then, focus more on the key of thematic issues rather than responding to certain issues?
Yes, thank you. Well, I also did have to.
Yeah, sure.
Thank you. I thought you were getting over.
No, I didn't realize you wanted to speak
here. I just put up my hand.
You want to speak until you communicate, so actually.
Yes. I did communicate. I just put up my hand. I thought you recognized me. Thank you. I just assumed I'm not under the. Thank you.
That's normally the way you can carry in
That's great. You've made your assumption that you wish. Chairperson, thank you for the opportunity.
I'm teasing you.
In terms of the engagement with SARS around
saying, I was not necessarily recommending that class started, but I was recommending that probably you consider a structure that is informed by the physical intergovernmental relations, but drawing from the expertise and experience of others. Because I think if we do that, I know that during my time as CEO, we tried it, it didn't work. But I'm talking about you now as the Finance and Fiscal Commission considering that particular structure.
Let's take that in notice. That's something that we will discuss with the Commission. And then on the issue of the structured relationships, we do have a structured relationship with the Municipal Demarcation Board that has been going on, I think, now for the past 3-4 years. That was established when I became the acting chairperson of the Commission. We did that specifically because of what we had observed, and you are right, in terms of the financial viability. But we also were looking at the fiscal sustainability of municipalities post demarcation. So, in fact, in our current submission, looking at 2016, we made certain recommendations on that particular issue, and we worked with the demarcation board primarily in looking at those matters. Yes, as I say, we've had a very strong relationship with that. As I say, we have influenced the collection of data that back in 1994-95, when the commission started its work, data was not being collected on quite a number of issues. If you look at the first submission of the commission, you will see a list of data that was supposed to be collected, which was not available at that particular point. But now, working together with the National Treasury and FARGA, we have actually influenced through the Statistics Council the collection of relevant data for this system of government. The second set of issues, the question is around the division of revenue and the smaller rural municipalities. There is work that we started in 2009, and a report that we tabled in 2012 that culminated in a revised local government of distribution. That report is called a review of the local government fiscal framework. We've actually reviewed that, and I want to say to you that I agree with you when you say, is it enough the resources that are put into local government? But the other question on the other side is like, can local government absorb those resources? Because if you look at the understanding, then you must start asking questions about do we choke them? Do we give them so much money that they choke on it? Or should we actually look at and kind of get to the issue of the capacity for local governments? I think if we actually look at the amount of money that has been spent on local governments, capacity building programs, you'd agree with me that this money goes down the drain. So the question that we are now looking at are how best do we design a local government capacity enhancement program, which is not solely premised on one national department coming in with this story and another department coming in with their own story, uncoordinated. We're now looking at ways of a comprehensive approach to building capacity in local government. And only then can then one say, are we giving sufficient resources? I can tell you that on the infrastructure side, the exercises that you conducted during that review indicate that on the infrastructure side, we are not giving sufficient to local governments. But at the same time, there's massive understanding. So local government's absorptive capacity is not there. And so we need to address those challenges before we get to it. And most of it, it's just dealing with your maintenance, refurbishment, renewal. The backlogs are growing around us, which means that you've got the backlog, the traditional type of a backlog, and then the ongoing backlog that's also as a result of lack of maintenance. So all of those issues mean that the share of the money going to local government must increase, but is that the right approach to deal with the problem? Probably not. So I'm saying the local government fiscal framework review is an ongoing process. At the moment, National Treasury, FARGA, the Financial and Fiscal Commission, and Department of Economic entering an evaluation, are engaged in a review of the grants for local government. I think if you look at the budget review, you see that story that the minister tabled to the table of the budget in February around the review of local government grants. And countries will basically be involved in a more direct way with the capacity challenges that local government is facing. You asked another member about the kind of challenges relating to the capacity to sustain local government, whether I can actually list. I think there's nothing new. These challenges basically are from a human resources point of view that actually local governments, different municipalities have different capacities. So your typically rural municipalities are unable to attract the right people. So when you provide consultants to build capacity or to assist them, they don't actually build capacity. They come and do the job themselves and then they leave. And they get paid and then they leave. So this is a problem that is beyond the control of the municipalities in those types of situations. But there are other challenges that relate to the employment practices where the wrong people are employed for the wrong jobs. Unqualified people, and I've also got generally detailed some of the things and I think that I need to repeat. And they are the same issues that we have identified that have been identified by the DG. Let me move on to the next set of issues about, I will ask Ramos to talk about our training program. But one thing that I can tell you is that the FFC has produced quite a number of people that have, when they leave the FFC, because we can't grow. So we don't have a very long career path at the Financial and Fiscal Commission. It's a small entity, high specialized people. So they actually end up working. The good thing is that most of them that leave commission end up working elsewhere within the public sector. And that for us is not such a bad thing. So the investment that we make on them actually assists that. And I also want to almost talk to the issue around the distribution, income distribution, and that Gini coefficient, what we can be sure can also talk later. Honorable Swart, the question that you raised around the shifting of this function and the consultants, and I think the Chairperson put it quite the transparent and comfortable discussion. Reject the Financial and Fiscal Commission period. Because I'll tell you that in April of this year, I received a letter from a commissioner of some transport, public transport entity in the city of Cape Town, requesting the Financial and Fiscal Commission's input within 2 weeks, I think it was, within 2 weeks on the assignment of the public transport function to the city of Kesa. And I responded to them, I said, but why are you coming with this week? Because the act says 90 days for commission to respond. Now, this decision has already been taken, it's an afterthought that happened to stuck somebody that the commission was not consulted. So these are the kinds of things that we have to deal with. Now, you can stop a process. And but why must you stop the process when decisions have already been taken if the people that it will impact on have not raised the question with you? So we then come in when we have to now quantify what is the size of the unfunded mandate. Then you quantify it and then suddenly people are like, no, but we will be. But it's there. The system has all of this inbuilt into it. That must avoid. And that's where the credibility aspects of it comes from. So if you undermine the institutions that are established to do that, that's where you end up. And so in quite a number of instances, we have been all instead of picking it up, because there's something like this that is happening, then you must write it later. No, we need to be consulted on this particular thing. But I think it's important, and I very much welcome the members. The suggestion that it actually be raised for the role player that not the either has is required in terms of the Financial and Fiscal Commission Act and also in terms of the business process. can just respond to us. Oh, sorry, let me just talk about the Westville issue. The Westville issue, what I'm saying is not that the size of the Westville does not matter. What we are saying is that when you look at the composition of expenditure, if you take government expenditure, there's a nice little chart that the National Treasury and the Minister of Finance likes to show. That basically shows you the percentage or the share of compensation to employees in the aggregate, compensation to employees against the rest of the expenses. And that basically tells you where we are spending our money. And you look at the share that goes to the economy, which is quite a critical element of trying to fit into that which we then also fit the social. So if it dies, if you neglect it, you have a problem. So the idea is to basically say, if we are putting money on the wage bill, what is it that we are buying from that wage bill? If we are buying from the wage bill things that are not welcomed by the South African society, so we're producing very poor services, then I can say, if you are producing poor health outcomes, then it comes back to the MTG story. Producing poor education outcomes, so you can have as much access as you like, but if you're producing a very poor results from the school system, then there's a problem. If teachers are being paid but they are not teaching, then there's a problem. So you've got all of the issues that are at play, which is why we think it's important to link that wage bill to the productivity. And the Public Service Commission's one of its responsibilities is to ensure that the public service is efficient. Now, from the commission side, what we are more interested in is when allocations are made, are those allocations spent in accordance with the preferences of the South African society? Now, if we put our hands together, we've got two different mandates, but they meet some. So we'll be able to deal with this particular matter in a more coherent manner, rather than the Public Service Commission doing only this aspect, that there seems to be no relationship. It's better that we actually combine some of the things where there's their common interest center. So that is how we come into the team. Even the corruption, so the commission's business is not investigating corruption, so we've got absolutely no interest. But the cause of corruption on the fiscals is an important part, because it's an inefficiency in the utilization. So that's how we come into this question. Let me just ask us to answer to the technical question.
Okay. Honorable, the development is actually engineering money. It's a major point in engineering coefficient. Mm-hmm. And what it does is simply a ratio which looks at how income is distributed between individuals. This is not to be confused with the measure of poverty. The measure of poverty will start from when you say, what is your poverty line for the country, 480 rand a month. Then you count how many people fall below that defined the poverty line. So the poverty, elimination of poverty by 2030 is looking at making sure that nobody has an income of less than a certain amount of rand a month. Income inequality is 0.6 is saying how to reduce the general income that the honorable member spoke about, so that your two patients within the society should see your neighbor with a Ferrari when you are walking to it. So that's in such a view that often. Now on the other training, structure training. Training is a very small part of our format. And the training that we have done, the ones that were called COC, members that we've identified to be directly related to the Department of Economic System, because we can't import even the small budget that we've got. We have given support for modeling skills, particularly for digital platforms, who send their tasks to spend some time.
we have worked with parliamentary committees, particularly appropriation committees, around different issues where we have done those things. And again, on request, we have worked with councillors. The last year we were in Bushback Ridge, where we were doing issues around financial management with councillors upon their request. And then importantly, we identified that part of what we saw as a missing link between our recommendations and their impact was that they are processed within relevant parliamentary structures. And we identify parliamentary structures as a key input into informing the committees on how to process their best recommendations. So in the past 2 years, we've been working with parliamentary researchers, particularly to train them on the technical work that has gone behind the recommendation that we come and make to the NGO committees.
And page 6, you talk about portfolio committees drafting of budget review and recommendations. So what exactly is your role in that regard?
Our role in the past has essentially been on advising the research on how to make the PRS report much more possible. The main idea there was we felt that particularly for appropriation committees, the timing of intervention is of utmost importance. So if the PRR reports are well informed by research, due to course by inflation or other evidence coming from say chapter 9 institutions and from their particular coming from the FSC to feed into influencing appropriation in the later years, so that would make those reforms quite powerful and influential in
after this meeting, what we'd like to talk about is what role, consistent with your constitutional and legislative mandate, you can play in the Empowerment Committee itself. We don't have the capacity to manage the millions of people here from the test division of NP and so on. I can't handle the test itself, which is the private party is very unlit. So we are looking at ways of empowering ourselves. We're drawing on all agencies that exist, which will cost us as little money as possible, that can, within their constitutional legal mandate, help us. There's a matter we'll deal with outside. Secondly, to say, if you look at our annual report to budget, you will see what we said there. We are going to now, very shortly, give the Minister of Space and Time, within the next month, write to the Minister and ask for this process to start. Looking, it may take 18 months or so, looking at the role of the FAC. We don't think an organization should exist, which is in the constitution, which is not taken seriously. So either we take it seriously and make the necessary adaptations to the laws and policies to allow for that, or we say we don't have it. But we can't be in the limbo. It's not in your interest, or in the interest of parliament, or indeed the government. So we alone are not able to decide the pace at which that inquiry is underhand. But that it should be on the agenda is something that we are acutely aware is necessary and long overdue. And we get a hint from some of the things that said previously you to feel that. So we're on the same page. After this meeting, we'll work together on pushing the process forward, and also we will have to take the terms of reference for it, and we need to, within the next 18 months, come to some sort of tentative conclusions on the matter. I thank you most warmly, and I wish you well. And if you have engaged in yet all parts, can you give me a formal invitation by the committee station, please, so that those members of the committee who want to go to your in government of fiscal relations workshop on the 11th and 13th content. I think you're inviting all committee members now.
Yes.
Fine. Yes, yes, but also I told you I won't speak. I don't know ready to. I'll share the session this, but the fear is that I'm in making input. That's not going to happen. If I make some inane comment on the board, let me just hear. Okay, and then when we more acclimatize with the area, and when we see more power, we are able to take on this issue. Thank you very much. Over into the Treasury. We have got, I think, my woman here, Treasury DNG, and his team. We'll keep on the votes that we're going to bring before us to Parliament.
those which we must go to the end of the year. I gather there's some tea and coffee that will come in at 2 o'clock, is that right? Yeah. Oh, what if the time has come to be told? In the meanwhile, there's no break. Let's carry on. You have got the documentation and the draft testimony.
Hello, Master.
Amendment bill and the draft taxation court amendment bill. Okay, it's right over to you.
Thank you.
be able to do it. Don't be honest, but thanks. But thanks.
Nobody here is an expert on everything. not going to be enough, I promise you.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah, but it's nice to match you. You don't even a single person, you know, to be able to really help us technically, but our future ahead. You know.
And
you're a quality person. Or we need another tax person.
And we also struggle to get staff because this is such a specialized area. So, but anyway, let's come to that. So, Chair, I'm head of tax and financial capital policy in Australia. Can I just ask you very quickly to introduce yourself first?
I'm Chris Tackleton. I'm the director for personal income taxes and savings.
And let me say, can I just apologize for Cecil Modern, who heads the unit that this reports to, who couldn't be here today. So I don't know, it's going to be hard, and it's very hard questions, but we've got enough experts here to answer.
The
Amber has replaced Keith Engel for members of the committee who were here last year.
From Hotek, I'm the Group Executive for Legislative Procedures Department at SARS.
Lieutenant Bobo, Director Responsible for International Tax and Tax Treaties International Australia.
So, Chair, you'll see that when we come on tax issues, we generally come together. So, it's always the Treasury staff delegation. And although we are Treasury is primarily responsible for policy and SARS for administration, but you'll see there's a lot of policy that SARS has to be involved in. And we do work jointly, even if there's a different lead player on different aspects of the legislation. So, Chair, so let's just start. I think it's quite important as we start just to go through how this process works, which I want to go through. So if you just press the button. Okay. As we know, because what we're here for today is basically the legislation to implement what the minister announces in the budget. Okay. Of course, in this case, it was also a different person who was the minister at the time. But Minister Gordon at the time, the budget, or ministers of finance do the budget around February. With that, they went to a budget review, okay? They put out the budget review. And although the minister will, you know, everybody looks at some obvious things that you can believe in the budget, like the price of street rents and excise duty on those will go on and whiskey, etc. You know, but the detail, you have to look at the budget review. And chapter 4, in the budget review, these four in the combined, actually have the detailed sort of policy proposal and the significant announcement that the minister has made. And then there's a bizarre section here called the National C, which if you have problems sleeping at night, you can leave. But what that covers is a lot of the technical amendments goes into a bit more gory detail of some of the rate changes. So that essentially and what happens is the minister immediately after the budget comes to the standing committee and leaves the committee the day after the budget on the entire budget, including on the tax proposal. Now, tax is such that because it's market sensitive, it's not something that we can consult players on the tax proposals we have in mind. It is secret until the minister actually announces it, or on the day. There's a lot of the journalists before then, but it's secret up to that. And if you can go ahead. And what happens is that the work really starts after the announcement. You can skip this, I think this just shows you just the kind of some of the key players in this. From SARS and from the Treasury. Okay. So as I said, the work actually starts after the budget announcement, and from that day, we, having made the announcement, we talk to particular stakeholders to try and develop the legislation. Now, and all tax legislation, like you dealt with the probation bills, are also defined as money bills in the Constitution, and therefore, they define by Section 77, they deal with the imposition of abolition or reduction of national taxes, levies, duties, or surcharges, and even if there's any exemptions from national taxes, levies, duties, or surcharges. Now, we have a current problem. We did amend the Constitution a few years ago, but frankly didn't go far enough, because there's a splitting problem. And so what happens is some of the tax bills have to be divided into Section 77, which is a pure money bill. Section 77 is in the Constitution. It refers to a section there, obviously. And if it deals with, I think the wording is, it cannot deal with any other substantive issue. So even if it's an admin issue in substance, it can't be part of the tax bill. And often tax policy and admin go together. So we have to split the bill into a non-money bill, which is a Section 75 bill. And because, remember, so you find there's an artificial splitting all the time of your major tax bills. I should add that both 77 bills also go through a similar process as 75 bills. So in this instance, the NCOP doesn't have the stronger powers it has when it comes to Section 76 legislation, which is legislation that affects provinces. And of course, the Constitution also says that the procedure to amend money bills. And in the Money Bills Amendment Procedure and Related Matters Act, there is a differentiation on how you deal with what they call revenue proposals. It's in Section 8 and 11 of that bill. And it's something that I think, Chair, you may want to just look at to see whether you are happy with the process that's been developed over time by your predecessors. But obviously, the very different way in which tax bills are dealt with, and I'll walk through that. Now, in terms of, and this is not exhaustive, there are several acts that are already there. The major tax acts that are there, income tax of 1962, okay, younger than me. Personal income tax, it deals with corporate income tax, deals with capital gains. There's a VAT Act, the Customs and Excise Act, more recently the Mining Laws Act, the Estate Duty Act, Transfer Duty Act. Last year we had the Employment Tax Incentive Act, there's the Tax Admin Act, which was passed about 2 years ago. And what you'll notice is that the tax legislation, therefore, every year that we present is incremental. It tends to add on to the current set of legislation. So if you look at the tax laws amendment world, it will amend many of these acts. And so therefore, it's written in the form of add this, delete that, etc. And so it's very hard to read the tax laws amendment book, because you have to go back to all this original legislation and check section by section and so on. Okay? Now, let me say, people like many of us in the region don't do that. We need that to be younger and the team to do that. Okay? But what we do is we publish an explanatory memo with the tax laws amendment bill, which then tries to explain in English what the various clauses are. So this is certainly the document that you should be able to read easier than actually reading the legislation. Which is not to say don't read the legislation. I'm just saying that's where the focus is. Move on. Now, if you look at the annual bill that we have there for our city budget, and yet, the reason why I said we ought to have this legislation is because if the tax bills are not passed, then frankly it becomes very hard to justify the revenue changes and revenue that the state will collect in next year. Many of these proposals, in fact, the customs and excise, some of those provisions, like, as I said, on tobacco and on alcohol, take effect as the minister speaks on budget day. Some, like your changes to the personal income tax table, are implemented from the 1st of March, so just a week or two after the budget. And of course, if Parliament were, say, to reject those rate changes, then all of that would have to be reversed, and that would normally be done, I guess, towards the end of the year. So it's reversed is we have now rates and money amounts and amendment of revenue laws for the mouthful. And this tends to be a pure 77 bill because all it does is it focuses on the rate changes and the threshold changes. So it just changes the numbers or the bands. Okay? And that's the first bill you have. We would have liked to publish this on budget day itself, but somehow that's just not possible given the work that even that requires. And I really would like to say it would be done in 2 weeks, but in practice we've needed more time and it's been done in June in the last few years. Then but eventually a bill that goes through quicker than the others. Then there's the tax laws amendment bill, which as I said is split up into two bills, which also deals with another changes to another bill, which is the tax admin bill. The TALA, not the Taliban, but the TALA. And so it needs to be split into money bill and a non-money bill. And that's normally the real typical bill that you have to deal with. It's normally released in July because, as I said, a lot of consultation takes place from February, and Danley and the team, and in fact the rest of the team, are extremely busy trying to get the actual legislation right, which is what we believe. In addition to the above, it could be that in some years, and we've done that, that there are still general issues around, and then we have a further revenue laws amendment bill. We try not to do that, but you know, there have been years and we've been forced to do that. And then there's this host of dedicated money bills. It could be a maritime levy, it could be an environmental levy, which get introduced as separate bills. Often this is driven by other departments. So if they have something and they want to have a levy on wastewater, you would have a dedicated bill on that. It could be a very short bill, but that bill has its own separate process. And then sometimes when we come up with new taxes, hopefully not too often, like we've done with the mining royalty regime, what we intend to do with gambling, or the ones with tax emissions like carbon tax. Those are very specific dedicated bills that we present, and we normally go through the normal, almost like very close to the normal legislative cycle, but taking into account the money bills that we get. So, yeah, and then, so, the big issue about this is how do we consult the public for these tax bills? And I think this is an enormously important point. And clearly, if not dealt with properly, we could be constitutionally challenged. As I said, no consultation takes place before budget day, before the announcements are made. However, of course, you had tips for Provino, tips for Trevor before how we have to change the name for the new minister. But what happens is we always take into account suggestions. People are free to send us tips or whatever they like, and we look at it. We don't tell them what we do with it, we don't respond to it, we just take that into account. But so the minister announces this, and as I said, some of the proposals, like on excise tax, like the budget day, others at the beginning of the tax year, which is different from the fiscal year that we have in government. And thereafter, as I said, there's limited consultations that they give back. It just helps us to draw the book up the bill and to see that we're not wildly wrong in what to say. And let me say, on tax legislation, it's possible to get things wrong. Because you don't understand, there's always winners and losers. You've got to weigh the two. You don't understand some, clearly because we haven't been able to consult, we perhaps haven't really understood. And sometimes we take U-turns, sometimes we take W-turns. But we try and say that we need to have thick skin and we need to be able to say we're wrong and to amend the legislation. That is very important for tax policy. We don't say once it's published, you know, we're not going to change no matter what. I think that's an important point to know. So what we do, Chair, is unlike the other bills, we publish this as draft bills. It's put on the Treasury and the SARB website, and it's either done in June or July, as I said. And then we take public comment for a period of months. Normally, then, in parallel, Parliament then has developed the practice of doing the same thing. So as soon as we release the bill, we have this hearing. But the only purpose is for us to inform you on what the goals actually do. And you get into the gory detail of how you're implementing the minister's proposals on tax. And this is also to get the public to know what his proposals are, and it, the goals are out for public comment. And it's to invite public comment. So Parliament then will normally have hearings for or 2 to 3 weeks after we've released the proposals. Go on. And often they, you know, the same sort of comments tend to you and to us directly as a strategy. Sometimes they can be different, but we take them all into account. And what we do, Chair, and this is what you'll hear, when we get it wrong, or someone is a loser in terms of the proposals, they'll scream and shout. So they will be here. You will hear that strategy's got this wrong, okay? And as I said, many, sometimes we have got it wrong. So that's, and so it's very important to hear what people are saying when they submit those comments. We then come to you with a response document. So this is done sometime in September after the closing date for comments and after the hearings you've held. We've also had some workshops around the comment that we've received to ask perhaps more questions of those submitting comments. And what we do is we then come with a response document that says these are all the comments and key proposals we receive. This we accept, this we partially accept, this we reject, and we give the reason. If Parliament is then happy with this at the level of the committee, we then revise the draft of the initial bill, and that is the bill that gets tabled in the Assembly, which is normally done sometime in October. Then, because you've had the trial and consultation process, Parliament has, in the last few years, had a very, the normal process, but it's a very short process where you go into clause by clause, and you consider the bill. And of course, if you want to make amendments, you've got to follow the Procedure Act, but you hope that the version that the Minister has tabled has already taken into account the comments made by members of the committee. And then, of course, the President may sign it into law in December or January. It's very important. There's a whole industry of very fast textbooks that go to explain the proposals every year, which students of taxation need, etc. So if you don't pass it in time, then the textbooks for the next year as well. So it has all kinds of effects. Okay, I should just add, there are challenges with this tax process because there is an asymmetry of response. So for example, there are issues, like you'll see there's a lot of wild stories about Japan. We actually go to those constituencies which we know will be challenged in terms of providing comments. So we go to the unions to say that these proposals on preservation, can you please make some comments? They, many times they don't submit these in writing, but we go to their workshop, we hear them and try and understand what they say. If there's something like we change the medical aid deductions into credits, you're not going to get individuals who come and talk to you. Okay? So we have to go to, let's say, groups that represent old people, disabled, and say, do these proposals make sense? Okay. Because the reality is that most ordinary people only know that the tax laws have changed on medical aid or travel allowance when they actually get implemented, which may be 2 years after you've looked at the legislation. And that's an asymmetry that we need to address and get more people involved. But the tight timelines also obviously work against that. So, Chair, now I'll move very quickly. So the base goal that you have today then deals with those such rate and threshold changes in income tax, customs duty, and excise duties. I've already gone through most of this, so I won't go through it again. And as I said, the TLAP deals with the most substantive changes, how you change the tax base, the actual wording. And can I say, Chair, this is where the tax law is different. When you look at the expenditure side, you have an appropriation bill which is of a few pages, and in effect, it's only giving money to state entities who then might give money to others. So the tax laws, in fact, apply to everyone in the country if they earn in some form of income or whatever, or they die, then there's a state duty. Whatever you do, you breathe, you move, you get taxed. So you need to have regulation because people legally will challenge you, and of course, tax is a form of coercion or contract with people, and you need much better and accurate documents. There's a huge lack of violence industry. Not huge, but it's there. Some has diminished it. But a lot of the changes then have to be, as far as becomes aware of the text abuse, they then make these changes more quickly. Okay. So, and these are some of the changes in the Salah Fund we'll talk through. There's just, we've just given you the schedule for the previous year as well compared to this year. So, Chair, that's the first, but it's just on the process. And I think what we're saying is, at some point, you may just want to consider the process and see whether this committee is happy with the process or whatever changes you want to make, because it's really your call, and the department will play on what you want us to do. So that's the first part of the presentation. Should I speed on to the next one? Okay. So now we want to present on the rates bill and what it does. Members have copies of the rates bill. And as I said, this is a pure 77 bill because it just changes the rates. So I mean, that just come in. We're going to just quickly give you the sort of background behind this bill because I think it's important to understand that more. Just to understand the taxes we have in our system, you've got a whole host of direct taxes, like the, you've got your tax on your personal income tax, the corporate income tax, the dividend withholding tax, state duty, etc. But you also have indirect taxes, like VAT, excise duties, security transfer tax, many of the environmental taxes, and this is a growing risk that you're going to have on the environment. Okay. Now, you will notice, and I'm going to ask this, just go through the next one, but you can start talking first. You'll see that in our tax system, three taxes, personal income tax, corporate income tax, and VAT, generate 81.7% of our revenue. A total of what, nine, what did you say? Nine, yeah, just over 900 billion rand. Okay, so 81% is just from these three taxes. The other tax, for example, the fuel levy, is just under 5%. Excise duties, 3%. Customs duties, 5%. Okay. So they very small. Chris, do you want to just shoot through this?
I mean, just to give a quick overview of the trends in the revenue through the years. I mean, this is just to show how did it grow each year on year, and you can see that revenue has really performed quite well over the years. It's grown about 10% in the majority of the year. There was a big blip with the global financial crisis in 2019, but immediately we've gone back to good levels of growth over 10% per year. As a percentage of GDP, this is quite an important figure that everybody usually looks at. How much of what you produce within your country is actually tax revenue for that year? We're sitting at around a quarter of GDP is taxed at about 26% at the moment. It's come up slightly from, say, 94, where it's 22%. Again, decreased versus the crisis. And the composition of the taxes. We know that federal income taxes, value-added taxes, and corporate taxes are the three main ones. And the ranking is still the same over the many years. So personal income taxes are the highest, then VAT, then corporate. But it has changed quite dramatically. You can see there in the middle of the graph, which has been 90s, corporate didn't pay that much. Personal income taxes was a lot more. That really has narrowed that gap. And we've lowered rates, but we've broadened the base, which means you've included a lot more things that should be taxed.
Yeah, and I know this will come to you later, but the greatest volatility you see with the corporate income tax. The other two taxes tend to be stable or they are rising, they rise slowly. But you've seen with the 2008 crisis how corporate income tax can fall dramatically. Okay, it goes from like over 7% to 5%. So all the shortfalls that you might get tend to be related to that. And of course other taxes like customs, for example, but that is the big one.
This is also just to show, I mean, we saw at the start of CIT and CRT, those are the two direct taxes that really just make up the most of the tax revenue, with the indirect taxes having about 40%. This is just to provide information so you can go away and keep this information if you like. but it's just with all the revenue figures and how they're broken down, and you can see the 900 billion there in the second last column on the right, that's how much money revenue was generated last year. The other table try and show the forecast, so it is quite difficult to forecast, especially within year, if there are issues that happen within the corporate sector and we don't make a match, or if consumption decreases and we don't make a match. So it's quite difficult to try and forecast if we have actually been quite close in the last 2 years. And that's just to give an overall trend. We can go straight into the rest of the luxury mouthful. So this is really what we, what have we changed, what have we done this year? In this rate of manageable, that's just a very simple change to use each year. I mean, the first one everybody should know really is income tax tables. How have we changed it? This is two income tax tables on the previous year on the left and this year on the right. It shows you the bands at which taxable income levels you are and how much of a percent of that you will pay. What is your marginal rate? So you can see at the top, if you're earning 700,000 rand, you'll pay 195,212 plus 40% the amount, that's 673,000. So that's how the table works. But as you can see, the values on the left have increased by around 5.4% of the values on the right. Now, these have huge revenue implications because this is obviously the largest revenue source that we have, and also it's just taxing a lot of people. So these potential changes have a very big impact. If you look at the next table, if we did
any changes on this, we deal with the problem of so-called fiscal drag. Because you get inflation, bands change, and if you get your normal inflation or increase, you might move to a higher band. So we try to adjust for that. Okay. And like Chris has said, those amounts can be big. So just adjusting for that, because we give up revenue of between 6 to 10 or 12, depending on earlier, right, during the figure.
Yeah, you can see the figure here is 9.25 billion. So if we didn't do anything, everybody would have paid 9.25 billion extra in tax. So because we've increased it to try and avoid this inflationary rate creep, there's 9.25 billion in relief in effect that we're giving to everybody. These are the tables that show how many people are within each taxable income band. You can see about, we expect about 6.5 million people to pay tax. There are about 50 million people registered with SARS. And of that 9.25 billion, I think the takeaway figure is that 40% of that relief will go to people below 250,000 rand income. I've got some quick slides on, well, how has this fiscal income tax regime changed over time? In the last 2 years, since 2023, there's been no changes in the rates. So the rates, the marginal tax rates that you see are, have been the same. So 18% from the lowest bracket to 40% if you're on the highest. The one in between have all been the same. There were some changes between 98 and 2023 where we decreased the rates. So we're going to do that in line of now including more taxable income within what we actually tax. So we have a lot more fringe benefits, which before weren't taxed and now are. There's also taxable gains tax and other things. But in essence, the tax table has really stayed the same over this period. And I've got all those data here for you to take away. And look at that leisure. Those are also the same. So if you look at actually the changes that we make, so you could increase by inflation each year, but it is a discretionary mechanism. So each year we look and say, well, how much money do we have? You know, is there fiscal space? Is there not? How much can we actually increase these variables? We try and provide bracket creep inflation adjustment changes each year. So in some situations you can't, and in others you can do more than inflation. So if you look at this graph here, this is just trying to show the dotted line is the change in the lowest income bracket over time. And then the colored line are what they would have been if they had just tracked inflation. So if you were 91 and we had just left the bottom bracket to track inflation, it would have grown very, very little, all the way to only about 21,000 or so. But because we've had some fiscal room in the past where revenues were very, very good during the 90s and the 2000s, you know, there was space to provide additional relief to the income tax system, so we pushed the brackets up by more inflation. So this is just to show that there is still this discretionary environment within the income tax table that we use to try and assess the economic situation that we're in at the moment. So those are the changes to the income tax table. The other major change we did in rates of money goal was the refund lump sum table. So if you resign from a job, you're allowed to take as much of that as you want as cash. We have a punitive tax table to try and discourage you from doing so. And we haven't, that came in 2007 and we haven't changed things and things. So we've adjusted them upwards by 10% just to try and take into account some impact of inflation. We also haven't adjusted the tax table when you get your lump sum or retirement. So when you retire, you can take up to one third of that as a lump sum of cash. And that has a, also has a tax table, but it's less punitive. And haven't adjusted that since 2011. So we also try to adjust that by around about 10%. The big change, if you look at diesel, the two tables and how you tax on those amounts that you get out of a pension fund as a lump sum. The big change was in the two red circles where we increased from 350,000 to 500,000. That really was to try and avoid individuals who are in provident funds who through their careers they would have contributed but they wouldn't have got deduction because they were below the first bracket. But now when they come to retire, they actually start paying tax according to these tables. And that was, we didn't think that was fair. So we've increased that by more than inflation to get up to the 500,000.
And I think this is an important point to note. We actually even worked against what we'd like to see that people deserve, but here we've actually made people who want to withdraw not the daily tax up to 500,000. There's lots of wild rumors going around that with some of the retirement reforms, people won't be able to preserve. People are checking out. Okay. Even on GPF, we are getting, lots of people have heard rumors. In fact, we've looked at various mechanisms to deal with it. So it's a wrong behavior, but it's also based on wild rumors, which were there when you had just getting to the run-up of 94 where people cashed out their pensions, okay, needlessly. So I think at some point I want to talk to you about retirement reform, but a lot of these somehow is just not understood out there.
Those are the changes to retirement tax tables. Also made inflationary changes to medical tax credits, which we do every year, so we increase the rand amount that you can see per month. We also increase the maximum value of cost of vehicle that you can get a company car allowance for. That hasn't been increased since 2011. And the capital income threshold for small business was also increased to match the tax-free threshold for individuals. I didn't mention that earlier, but if you increase by inflation brackets, in fact you're increasing the tax-free threshold from 67,000 to 70,700. So anybody who has income below that doesn't pay any tax whatsoever. I'll go through very quickly on the others. On excise duty, we have a targeted tax burden on weighted average retail selling price of alcohol beverages. That we made slightly higher than inflation adjustments to the alcohol excise duty to try and get towards that retail average weighted selling price targeted tax burden. We were a bit below it. For tobacco excise duties, we were pretty much on the retail, the targeted tax burden for the retail selling price. So because we were pretty much on that level, we only increased by inflation for most of those. And the table here with all the instances are there.
Mr. Chair, we would have liked to jet this up even more. But of course you have the problem of smuggling cigarettes, which France can talk about. So you have to find the right balance because it gets to the issue of how you can enforce on your borders products that come in that are not produced yet, which avoid the tax.
And that's everything on that was within the rates and money goal. Do you want to talk about your leave?
Yeah. For your information as well, just go through it, yeah. We thought we should just provide you some info just on a few levels since it is out there in use. And these were the changes we made in the budget that go on. And this just shows you the composition. Again, look at this slide that you're laying, and at some point we'd like to come and explain this, because when you see this whole debate about how to fund toll roads and so on, most of your fuel levy is the general fuel levy. There's a number of elements, but it goes into general revenue. So if you were to use this for something else, you'd still have to tax more to make up for the shortfall. And you can't really attribute, therefore, how the fuel levy is spent, because most of it is just general and goes into the national revenue fund. You'll see that it's, in fact, with the increase in prices, okay, which is not, which which is of course not something that South Africa can influence. But you see that the share has fallen quite dramatically. And in fact, many people who think that by increasing it you can fund other activities, well, this is something one needs to understand. And some of this is happening because people perhaps are not using, or not, it's not growing in terms of the volume, but also because cars, for example, are more efficient, so fuel efficient, so you have to take that into account. Then I think, Chair, the one big area you're going to hear about is the carbon tax. We think this is probably the biggest challenge facing humankind. We do need to do something, and South Africa is committed to certain targets, and there's no doubt that tax on carbon emissions is probably the most effective way at this stage to bring in the real cost to society. But that, as I said, would be a separate bill which we're working on, which we hope to bring later in the year. So, Chair, that's all on the rates bill. I don't know if I want to stop for questions or if you have any questions.
Chair, I just wanted to understand, and obviously this is the first time that we're hearing a very elaborate presentation like this on taxation. I wanted to know what are the global trends in as far as the personal income tax and the company income tax? What are the global trends? Because I'm looking at it, it's a, yes, it looks good, certainly. You know, your personal income tax accounts for more, and only three types of taxes account for 81% of the overall regulated tax, your company income tax and so forth. But what are the global trends? Because I'm not sure what's happening out there. And it's not an area that I've been following, it's not an area that I'm very, that is my area, that is my area of work. The other thing that I also wanted to know is around, you know, one of the things that one has observed is that many, and this is across the board, and South Africa is a water gas country, but we have seen the pollution of our rivers is just sky high, and the older water course, I'm sure they will agree with me, we've had the treatment costs of our water has gone up. Even the quality of our water that we once used to enjoy in the summer space, you can now even start smelling at the odor of these chemicals and so forth. Now, is that something that is in the, we were talking about today, the green gas emission tax, whatever, is that within that? Because part of the major problem is that you've allowed a lot of development to happen along the rivers. And many companies, they simply dump whatever chemicals and so forth. In fact, the water in Durban, I can tell you about Durban, because I'm from Durban, most of the rivers, if children go and swim in those rivers, definitely they come back with the, what do you call it? Anyway, but we are saying that how polluted our waters are, and I think it could be one of the reasons that we could consider in the taxation. But the other thing that I wanted to know, especially when it comes to personal income tax. Now, in South Africa, we have very big, I mean, the gap between the income gap is very wide. Now, we have retail. Yeah, let's take one of the major retailers, I'm not going to mention the name, but you will know which one it is. Where your employees are earning, they are not even employed permanently, but you have the CEO given probably 67 million bonus. What are we doing to deal with those? Because if we are going to be addressing that effectively, the income gap inequality, you could also be putting a very heavy tax burden on those performance, so-called performance bonuses, because we've seen things that are really so immoral when it comes to these performance bonuses. And some of these performance bonuses go to 200 and something million. I think there's space there as well to look into that.
And maybe you can verify to me, because probably it's something that you are already looking at it. I think I would leave it there for now, Chairperson. But and say that, I mean, I think I'm very happy with the way you are getting into a lot of issues already. But obviously, we would want you to comment more on what is the legislation. Is there any legislation? I know it's a sensitive issue. Was it seen in the letter that has been with this committee on price shipping and illicit traders and so forth? Do we have the legislation that is pending currently? Because we need to come up with something. I know people have asked me that, no, this is an international phenomenon and what have you, but what are we doing as South Africans? I mean, on our side, what are we doing to deal with those from the tech side? Thank you.
Thank you.
Chair, I want to propose a process issue. One, but even before I do that, I just want to ask National Treasury at one point whether this process happens every year after the minister has tabled the budget. That's my gun point. Does it happen every year? Mm-hmm. We have to come together and do the thing and analyze. Chair, I want to talk to you. One, given what a presentation for you and the timelines and what is required so that in September, October, the minister is able to do that and by January the key revenue tech book, whatever. We have that other portfolio of appropriation and you have us. And there are certain things that we have to also inform the public on so that they are on board by the time the president signs this into the law. That there must be public hearings and other things. Between you and me, Chair, we will need a session with that portfolio committee where we can systematically look at all those things and then be able to run this process and educate the public around some of the things that they also have to have interest on. In empowering government, you know, we said that the people shall govern, and we have to see some of these things coming into it. I mean, I've been a member of the legislature since 1999, and I've said in a number of things, the only engagement that we normally have at provision level, when we deal with DORA, with the FSC, when the FSC comes with a big document that we talk to, which affect provinces and other things. So it's something that we have to take very seriously and say it's a new member of this committee. So there are codes of good practice that we can also learn from this to make the public aware of the implications and the importance of a valid speech. Because I know there are people, a certain category of people, who don't do anything on that day because they want to hear the pronouncement of the minister. Because some of these things have far-reaching implications on some of the activities that they're doing. But the general public is not empowered. And in the same way that people have now started to have interest on parliamentary proceedings, I don't know because of what, or maybe they want to see that overall, how we do that. So we have to not start to make our people to have interest on the national treasury activities so that they too cancer 3 years back, and I was proposing, it may not be something that affects them, but between us and the portfolio committee on appropriation, we need that session a day or so, look at all these things broadly and check every implication of all those taxation issues that are there, structure and public hearing, and then do that. By the time we speak to the minister, the minister presents to the legislature, we know. We have also taken our people in confidence. It's not just here, but we know our people are involved. They were part of this process we have confirmed. The second issue is around the 900 billion rand collection. It will be interesting. They are saying it's whatever, just about 80% of most of the taxation comes from those categories and constitutes 900 billion. It will also be interesting as to what constitutes the percentage of that from the categories of those people who are currently employed. If SARS collecting, the collection by SARS, has it gone, is it, can we say we have covered more ground, or this is just a tip of an iceberg, something like that? No. Have we just scratched the surface, or we can even go further than that? I'm saying this because of the budgetary concerns that we have, competing needs that are there, and all other things that has the ruling party in a social transformation agenda activities that we have, what the 3 years of government wants and so on, vis-a-vis our revenue base and other things. So it's one of those things that I also wanted to check. Thanks, Chair.
Thank you, James. Thank you for the presentation. It's indeed very useful. With regards to the funding tax, yes, indeed, I would make the assumption that the 20% in terms of company tax, ideally it should be the top bracket, that we should actually create more jobs, establish more companies, and it's an indication that in terms of our relative target that, you know, that we can, should do more to enhance the establishment of companies. And the 20% is, to me, disappointing that investors are still paying more than companies. So it would be very interesting when you respond to the question of my colleague regards to the international situation. And then, secondly, yes, I think in terms of personal income tax, it needs to be committed that there's a consistent approach in terms of this, although 40% of taxation, of course, is high. It's heavily taxed. Fortunately, that's not over tax, but we need to note that we pay on par tax. But it's encouraging that it's consistent and that we a tremendous amount to pay 40% on the income. And I don't see anything of a super tax that is highly publicized. Hopefully, that will not be implemented. People's ideas are not well creating efforts from young people. And then the last one, with regard to inflation-related increases, the income for personal income tax, the bracket is pushed up much higher than inflation, but the economy contracting, hopefully that improves. What would your position be, do you think, in terms of there could be more inflation-related, the ideal situation to have those increases for personal income tax and inflation-related? As you've indicated in, on your chart, it is pushed up above inflation. Retirement funds, yes, I think a good presentation with regards to this will be very helpful. The rumour out there in the public that people are petrified about losing their retirement fund and the fraud of this definitely so, and I get a lot of calls with regards to that. Currently, is it that they can only with the one third? So, you know, it's a little bit of a nice chunk. And the taxation on that specifically, I find the 36%, 27%, and 80% to be very high percentage on retirement companies taxation. People work their whole life, they pay as they earn, they pay reserve some of the money when they need that money for all the I consider this to be a double taxation. If we can look at those issues and encourage savings, of course, that would be very helpful. And I will not go to the carbon tax issues. I think that would be appropriate to discuss later on. Just to note again, I think it will have massive unintended consequences. And then the fear of living, the increase in road accidents. Many people consider this also. Those are the issues that we can address to make it a bit easier for the consumers out there, for commuters. Is there no the increase in general fear of living in line with inflation that I can support? The increase in road accidents come on a yearly basis, perhaps a percentage, and that could be helpful to assess whether we can take us something down in terms of taxation. Ultimately, I think we need to tax people as low as possible and make it easier for people in very difficult circumstances. That can be in very constrained circumstances in terms of the economy. Thank
you. The residence review document, if we can be
okay, over to you.
On page 8, the very first part is on the annual tax bill. I think what I got an understanding that is basically a very, very subtle appeal on what we need to do as a committee to try and address some of the matters in there, unless if I got it all incorrectly. If they eat, would we still go back to it and just explain exactly what this committee needs to do, you know, pertaining to the US-77 deals and whatever. If that is the matter, then let's talk about it, if the committee is expected to do something. On the issue of the retirement, which is the second point, the input that we got was that a lot of people, even prior to 94, they got quite a lot of their money. And then we've got a problem where in our country, most of our people are not saving their money. They are actually using their money in a way that is unacceptable. I think in Australia and other countries, they've actually even used the retirement age from even 65 to 70. What are the chances of doing this as a way of saying to people, keep on working, keep on saving, in order for you to get your money at a later time? Is that a possibility? We'll also look at that. The third point is on the climate change, I think it's on page 29, on the issue of, I think there was the issue of the ETOs and the payment for ETOs and everything else. How much of that has been done to really try and engage these type of issues? Because, you know, the fuel levy and everything else we had, that the fuel levy, the amount that is collected may not be enough. Is there a possibility of looking at what appears here on page 29 as a possibility that you could use to just put in more money towards that type of thing? Thank you.
Point is sharp with five. Can I just request you to follow the thing? How far are you in your input as a whole presentation?
More substantive bill.
I mean, it's too far. Ask for an hour to hour and a half.
Yes.
No.
We can do it. That depends, obviously, when you do the questions and so on.
Obviously, when you make an input, you can't expect them to.
Sure.
It's like dummies.
No, I'm not saying that.
The question we've got to ask is, I can take a little consumer from crop us for that amount. And Makosi and the rest of the members, how long do you need to keep them? Just till 5 o'clock, I'm cool. But I'm out of here. Because the deal we struck with Cindy and with you in particular,
yes,
was an hour and a half, plus an hour. Now, at this stage, it's going to be at least, we started at 12 to 12, it's an hour now. If you lock off the cut of part, that's done. So can you negotiate time properly in future? But I can't, I've got to go. Of course, you go at 1:15, and then you're free as members to sit till 5 o'clock if you want. I'm cool. I ain't coming back. What time can you stay?
Chairperson, I could stay until 1:30. Yeah.
Thank you.
Charlie can meet that two of spoken, but I made a proposal that we actually the proper session on the
system. Yeah, I know all of that, but there are also implications about that, because I think some of the things you're suggesting are in principle correct, but given the earnest deadlines we have with this team, and I think you weren't, I need to speak to you about it, we have limited choice. What we're doing through right with the budget review is we're going through this process because of the circumstances very different in ways that are not invisible to us, but certainly it will not happen again because next year we'll have proper world elections, of course, and so on. Of course, how are you doing? They can set up a small architect one to keep your call on how you.
I think we've always said the half one is fine for us, and that's the deal, I thought, right? So, and look, Chair, I think what we said is, and we are rushing to do it in that time, if we can do it.
Yeah.
So that's where we would do it. I think what we wanted, and I'm not going to answer all the questions now, because I want us to go on to the presentation, and some of the questions will get answered. But let me just say very quickly, two or three quick things. I think, Chair, what we want to do is, if we want to have a workshop, we can go through this, obviously in more detail, slower, because we're going through this very fast,
yeah.
Okay?
Yeah.
And so I must apologize for that, but I think we want you to get a taste.
Yeah.
We know that on the budget, there's a lot on the expenditure side, but this is critical, and it's different, okay? So we'd be happy to do a longer workshop,
yeah.
Where we're not around legislation. Here we're only trying to explain the incremental changes we've made. We're not going into the issues. So the question about comparing with other countries, you know, like anything, it would be better to do it at a workshop.
Yeah,
but,
no problem.
You know, so similarly, the issues on retirement, Chair, can take us many hours, okay?
Mm-hmm.
So I think that's the issue. What we actually want in terms of the process, Chair, is that for the committee to obviously set, normally between 2 days of hearings or whatever, depends on submissions you get, but in August, so that at least the process can start and you hear the comments to the bill, and then obviously set the response time, and then maybe just a rough schedule for to the rest of the year, you know, what will we do when? I think that's what we wanted. If I have your permission, Chair, can we move on to the presentation? We'll try and answer some of the questions through that, because I think the questions are important. And we do want to answer.
I'm happy with that.
Yes, I have to check the question.
Okay. So we get on to now the really stuck bills. It's actually, as I said, all these bills, the bills are split into some technically two bills, taxation law and medicine bill. But they also cover the third bill, which is the Talab bill, which France will go through. So there are three bills that we're talking about. Let's be quite fast again. We just want to alert you to what the big issues are in the world. This one's
okay, I'll start with the income taxes on setting. We've got a slide on the main retirement reform. Do you want to talk to those now?
No.
Let's just move through the. So the main change we did last year was to the taxation of retirement contributions. This table is going to show you all the different ways different contributions were taxed to different funds. It's a very complicated, very difficult. Last year we simplified it dramatically so that everybody can contribute the same regardless of which fund you're going to, and then the deductibility limits are all the same as well. So we simplified it dramatically, and we've done a couple of further additions because this will come in on 1 March 2015, so we need to work with defined benefit funds. We've done a couple of further amendments. For tax-free savings accounts, this is what the big push forward is for, to try and increase household savings. This provides legislation to actually do that. We're proposing that you'll have an account that you can put in up to 30,000. Any growth, anything you earn on those amounts will all be tax-free for as long as you live. So you can put in 30,000 this year, 30,000 the next year, but all that growth will be tax-free. We've had a couple of discussion documents in the last 2 years. We've received a lot of comments from the public, a lot of comments from everybody. We've changed the policy at the corners. And this really puts in the legislation on how all this actually works. Information session, I'm moving on. Okay. The valuation of fringe benefits for defined benefit contributions. This is in relation to that simplification of the tax regime. Defined benefit funds are interesting because it's not all money. It's if you work, you get a lack of pension when you retire, but the contribution won't exactly match the value of the benefit you will receive. So we can't tax you on the contributions if that's not actually the value that you receive. So we're going to kind of approximate the value of the benefit that you get and tax you on that approximation. So we put out the first batch share of the T-Lab about a month ago. Because this is quite complicated, I mean, we put out an initial first batch, which we don't often do, but it's because it was complicated, we got that first batch out, received comments, now we put it out again so that we can receive comments. The retirement fund accrual date, we've changed the date of retirement. At the moment, if you're working and the retirement fund says that your retirement date is 65, at that date you have to take your retirement funds. So that creates complications both for the retirement fund because you then need to elect how much of that you would like as a lump sum or how much you would like as an annuity. Because individuals might take their time to elect, it's difficult for the fund to withhold tax, and also it forces the individual to retirement. So what we're now proposing is that the retirement date is the date you elect to take a lump sum or annuity. So in a sense, everybody can now determine their own retirement date. If you want to carry on working, and if you want to keep your funds in the pension fund, you may do so. So we think this fits with the retirement form. We've also tried to simplify things for evaluation of fringe benefit for employer-provided accommodation. At the moment, this is based on a formula, and firms could apply to SARS for a directive to use the actual value if the actual value were lower than the formula. We're now saying that if it's just a third-party transaction, but if you're not connected in any way, you can just use that value without actually having to apply for SARS. So this is something that simplifies the system and makes it easier for everybody. We've done a couple of technical amendments on when you can get a deduction for a key person insurance policy, i.e. if you're the main income earner for the firm. We don't allow a deduction if you pay for insurance for a business loss of that person if you were to become disabled or die. And that insurance, that amount that you've actually insured, is just to pay off the debt. If it's just to pay off the debt, then you're not allowed a deduction. So you are allowed a deduction if it's to pay for income that you would have lost as a result of the business not being able to perform because you were a key person. And then we've also had a technical amendment to the strangers trade fee, which is when somebody pays someone else to not trade in that environment. So I'll buy your business, but I'll pay you ~1 million not to actually use that business or actually be active in that area for the next 3 years. So those payments, we previously had taxed to avoid situations where firms employ people but then give them restraint of trade payments so that they can avoid income tax. But we went a little bit too far after we were restricting the scope now so that those restricted payments aren't actually taxed as income. So it's a clarification from the previous payment. And that's all the business income. Thank you.
Okay, how are you doing there? Business taxes. The business taxes are divided in three, especially for those ones that collect the anomalies in the Income Tax Act. That's internal application of the Act. So in this one, for the division of contributed tax capital, this deals mostly with big malpractice, whereby we collect the division of contributed tax capital so that it covers some of the things that were left out in the previous legislation. The rationale being that when you do some of the decisions, you don't know how it impacts. So, as soon as the application comes in, then the taxpayers will come and complain and say that it does not reach the intended effect, and then we just collect the anomaly by amending the decision of contributed capital. Okay, secondly, we have two slides, the first is the tax section. I'm going to see the four slides together. Here, we've got other avoidance rules that aim the targeting preferential tax effect by third party. So in this case, in both the two slides, those are the avoidance rules were introduced. However, they were unintended anomalies that are trying to correct. So in both the two slides, refinancing and asset section, which is the next slide, they are trying to correct the unintended anomalies so that we can allow, so that they cannot have a negative impact in the application of the legislation. The third one, which is
a little bit big one because it deals with space erosion and shifting. It's a diminution of interest question. I'll do a little bit here because these are the measures that have been introduced by the G20 and the OECD countries regarding space erosion and shifting. We also introduced the rules in 2013 regarding the limitation of interest deductions, whereby we limit the interest deductions that are paid to, you know, to exempt entities, being exempt entities in the country or people foreign persons. And then we limit interest paid in respect of funds used to fund the reorganization acquisition transaction. So we introduced these rules last in 2013. However, there were unintended anomalies regarding the formula used because currently the formula is set at 40%. And then there is no movement in terms of whether the formula can move. It can only move when the interest rate goes up to 10%. So the business came to us and said that the fact that the formula moves when the interest rate is only increased to 10% does not take into account the fluctuation because the interest rate fluctuates daily or most of the time. And also don't take into account the cost of doing business. So proposals, so we made changes in the legislation whereby we made proposals that the formula should be amended and the formula should fluctuate based on the interest rate changes and the cost of finance. And also even though the basis is 40, we say that if the base is 60, you cannot, the formula can move between 40 and 60, but nothing more than that because 60 we thought that is too high. Yeah. So what happens is that even though we've got 40, I want to go on the truth now. Here is the information from State South Africa, which shows that our 40 is even too high, which will allow the deduction. Because the information from State South Africa shows that it's like 30% that is the interest expense to EBITDA ratio. So it means that the 40% is too high. Maybe we can consider to reduce the 40-30% because based on the information we have, the 40% is too high because it only high interest expense to establish it only high on electricity. And that electricity relates to ECOM, which is the only company that does that. And then also the comparison by country and size, that is international comparison from the OECD, it shows that even the 40 is high because most countries like 20 to 25, you can only get 40 on Brazil and Iceland. So meaning that our 40% is too high. That's why we wanted to highlight here that because our 40 is too high based on our research in South Africa and also based on international comparison, we may seek to reduce the 40 to 30%. That is the gap. Okay, so this one deals with financial institution products. In the 2014 budget, the minister announced changes to the taxation of long-term insurance. The nice thing is that, as Mr. President, we published this with the first batch of legislation because it was considered to be difficult, so we've already got comments. So we received the comments in the first batch of legislation, and then we did some changes. So the what we are presenting today is that we've taken into account some of the comments because what the minister announced was that the first end of the risk business of long-term insurance will change based on the profound processes. The business will no longer be taxable on individual policyholder fund or company policyholder fund. It will be taxable on the corporate fund. Because we thought that this is difficult, it is going to affect the long-term insurance, the release on the family. However, the effective date of this legislation will be 2016. Because we understand the unintended consequences that the insurance business will need maybe to change their product and to change their way of doing business. So we are giving them a longer term. Even though we introduce it now, it's not going to happen in 2015, it's going to happen in 2016. And then now, the last category of business tax deals with tax incentives. These tax incentives are assisting encouraging growth in the business sector. The first one is the distribution machine allowance for transmitting electronic communication. Currently in the tax system, the depreciation allowance for telecommunication systems, like for cables, is normally 20 years. And that depreciation allowance is not allowed if the asset is a used asset. So looking at the international trend, they say that it's difficult to take out the current cables that are there and put the new ones because it's the whole issue of infrastructure. So now what we are changing here
we are saying that if it's used, it's fine, because we understand that we cannot take the infrastructure that is there to replace the new one in order to get the depreciation. So we are changing that, and then we are lowering the year from 20 to 15 years. And then the second one is the sector development tax incentive. Over the past years, we've been making changes to R&D tax incentives. However, we found that some of the changes that we've made in 2016 have unintended anomalies that they don't reach what we wanted to do. So this, we are trying to correct that, and the changes on R&D are mainly for clinical trials and pharmaceutical products. So, and also, you'll be elective for the incentive based on regulation, and then the regulation are published with the year. And then public-private partnership. What you know is that government enter into 50-50 arrangements with the private sector, whereby government cannot be able to do some of the improvements on government-owned land. So currently, there is in the Income Tax Act provisions to allow for the private sector that has entered into a 50-50 arrangement to be able to claim allowance. However, we found that over time, the 50-50 arrangements divide. Like, for instance, what we catered in the S-Current is that if the PDP occupies the land and uses the land, we did not cater for the fact that whereby the private person will service government and that government still occupies the land. So what we are doing now is to make changes to allow for the service agreement. And then with oil and gas incentives, we've got currently the 10 state we're dealing with oil and gas incentives. The problem here was that companies that enter into joint venture agreements, the legislation was not clear whether if they got a fiscal stability agreement, can they share that fiscal stability agreement. So now here we are correcting that anomaly that is companies that have got a FSA agreement and they enter into a joint venture, they've got the right to share that agreement because it relates to both them. And then we've got other industrial policy projects we were introduced in the income tax some time ago. We found that the difficulties in some, for instance, if the taxpayer who is in the industrial policy project does not own the immovable property, it's difficult for them to claim the IOC. So we are deeming someone who is doing the industrial policy project to own the immovable property so that they can claim the allowance. And then the special economic zones. This is, we are doing this in consultation with the DTI, which is the driver of the SDZ legislation. So what happens is that now the SDZ legislation will come into effect. So there are tax incentives that go with the SDZ legislation. So we are refining those tax incentive provisions that go with the SDZ so that when the SDZ legislation comes into effect later this year, then our tax act is up to date. The venture capital regime is more of, it was introduced in 2008, and we found that there's little uptake because of the unintended anomaly regarding this. So in the TT lab, we're making provisions so to expand the venture capital regime so that we can have more uptake in the regime. The small business, there was an outcry by taxpayers that small business is difficult for them to get grant funding because they are small business, they cannot fall into the PBO phase getting grant funding because they are actually doing business. So we've made measures whereby small business can get grant funding, and then the person providing the grant will have the relief as if it's an exempt entity, and then the small business receiving the grant will also be exempt from the money receiving the grant. We want to allow small business to get funding. Grant funding. Here, the small business taxation regime, this was a recommendation by the Dutch Tax Committee regarding small businesses. So here, what we're doing is that we are replacing the SBC regime with a full refundable tax compliance rate. So the legislation is out there, and then we are receiving comments.
Can I just say, just on this one, the Davis Committee has released its support. It's also taking comments. So you've got two processes of comments have been taken. So we're going to have to work with them to see, finally, once we receive the comments, how you take this forward. So it's just there are two processes I wanted to be aware of.
Okay, good question.
The equalizer.
Yes, and then
two requirements that employ tax incentives to make it simpler and easier to use. The one is on the hours of work. If you have people, someone who's working for you part-time, you need to use your own discretion to see how you can gross up the value of the wage to calculate the value of incentives. Whereas clients, you now set a fixed written response of 160 hours as a working month, so that it's easier for firms to gross up and gross up. The other thing is we're looking to change the reimbursement mechanism and the cap behind the reimbursement mechanism. So if you're a small firm and you don't have enough energy and liability to claim the employment tax incentive, FAS will actually give you cash when you then get to a point where you can claim it, which can then be done through the reimbursement mechanism. We've changed the way that this is rolled over and the way that the caps are applied there, so we've also asked for comments on that.
Just 3 minutes.
Thank you, Chair. We definitely three major amendments that we made in our international tax area. The first one is transfer pricing similar adjustment. What this rule seeks to prevent transfer pricing rules is a situation where you have South African entities shifting their income or offshore to related entities. For example, we have Rafael Sassidia is selling goods to its offshore entity. Instead of the offshore entity paying the full price, pays less price, for example, who pays 5 million for those goods instead of 100 million. What we did in the past, in 2011, we aligned our trust pricing rules with OECD. We said the secondary adjustment, otherwise the shortfall, the 5 million, will be deemed to be low. But that has given rise to a lot of practical and administrative difficulties on the side of SARS and the side of the taxpayer. With change control issues, with accounting issues, that we had to take into account. What we are proposing now is that instead of giving that secondary adjustment to be a loan, we deem it to be a dividend. And it will be subject to different tax at a rate of 15%. And we've had discussions, consultation with both private sector and SARS on this issue, and we have consensus. The second proposal is only currency acquisition of assets. When a person ceases to be prior to December last year, when a person ceases to be a South African resident, otherwise when a person immigrates, we impose a charge, but we had exceptions for immovable property that has been holds in South Africa, or shared in the property of each company. But there's been a lot of abuse where people then exit and use bilateral agreements to ensure that they don't pay tax. There were some weaknesses in some bilateral agreements, which we have renegotiated. But the rule that we introduced last year, we said if you emigrate, your interest in a property-rich company will be deemed to have been disposed that interest on a day before you emigrate, and will be subject to an exchange for capital gains tax. However, there was a small challenge there. We didn't clarify in what currency. When you emigrate, let's say for example, you emigrate to US. You emigrate to US, we didn't clarify whether the currency of reacquisition, so preparing that asset, is either the dollar or something like that. These rules clarify that. And they say the currency of reacquisition is the currency of which you acquire that asset, that was still in the rent. The next change was a simplification of foreign business establishment exemption. We have rules that are called controlled foreign company rules that seek to add avoidance rules to prevent people from shifting offshore their income offshore through setting up of intermediary holding currency. But we have foreign exemption. What we want to prevent is people setting up such terms that do not really make sense. So you don't have operations that set offshore. So we have exemptions for subset offshore, but then these exemptions were the problem was the way it's complicated. So we're trying to simplify that. If you make one exemption,
but has to still meet the requirements for an allied country.
Thank you. France will do the VAT and the second law. I want to stick to our commitment.
I always find myself in situations where I need to stick to the commitment. So, very quickly, on the first one, this is actually a little bit of trend. This is the withdrawal of the VAT zero rate. A little bit of background. In a consumption tax, which is what value added tax is, you don't want to tax the businesses, you want to tax the final consumer. Now, back many years ago, we had something called GST, and the way we avoid taxing the business was by giving people certificates, and they would use the certificate not to be charged the GST. So the business, like, they did my certificate, don't charge me. As you can imagine, what happened then was people used other people's certificates to get the exemption, or you used your certificate for things you were supposed to use it for. So we moved to what's known as value-added tax, and what happened there was everybody paid the VAT, but if you're a business, you can claim back what you paid. Right? So that way there's better control, so I can track who's paying whom, when, how, and we had a handle on what's happening. It was one industry that did not get brought into the system. It was the agricultural industry. They were still permitted to use certificates. And unsurprisingly, what we've discovered is they're not working very well. We have detected just over 600 million rands in real losses so far in the last fiscal year. And our estimate is we could be looking at approximately just under 4 billion rands worth of losses per annum. So that's pretty significant numbers. So what we're suggesting is we need to bring the farming industry into the general rules along with everybody else. We do understand that may mean there's some cash flow issues for farmers, and we're trying to work with them to resolve it so that there won't be that kind of impact that they're worrying about. Because with a certificate, you don't have to pay up front and can refund. Now they're going to have to pay and can refund. We're trying to make sure that doesn't impact their cash flow. And we had a meeting with, in fact, a couple of meetings in South Florida, one on Monday this week, to try and keep that moving. On the second one, notional input of gold. As I mentioned, when you, as a business, you buy, you can claim back for that you paid. But that means the other person had to have charged you that. Right? That's it. What we do is when you buy second-hand goods, the person who originally paid for those goods paid that, then maybe it moved through a couple of other individuals, and then finally it gets sold into a business. What we say is we will give you emotional input. We will pretend there was that built into that price, even though you didn't buy from someone who charged that. And that's to try and cater for the fact that that was originally charged many years ago. It's a great idea from a policy perspective, you need it, but there's a little problem. What happens if you're dealing with illegal goods? So, and a high value illegal good. And here's the case we're bringing to you, it's gold. It could be illegally mined gold, it could be gold that has been smuggled, or it could be stolen gold. Right? So then you have an issue that what's happening, we're having this kind of illegal gold entering the supply chain, and we're actually giving them that back for it. We're saying this is a very significant problem. And what we're suggesting is when we hit this kind of issue, we don't give that deemed input, that emotional mass back. And then finally, there's the VAT exemption for legal tender. This is something that's intended to help the Reserve Bank try and make things a little more consistently. We hope we succeeded, and if we haven't, I'm sure they will tell us very shortly. Moving on then to the administrative side, I'll try and take maybe 2 minutes on this. So starting with the first one, you know there's a dividend withholding tax. That works fine in dealing with cash because if I need to give you 100 rands worth of cash, I can take 15 rand off it and give 85, send the other 15 rand top. Easy. What happens if it's an asset? So what happens if the company doesn't pay it? And there are situations where the company pays it because its shareholders are operating with it. And then the shareholders finally do cooperate and it needs to get money back. At the moment, the Act doesn't require for them to get the money back. This is the amendment just as those happens. Original tax system, what we're trying to do here is we're just trying to make it a little bit more friendly for taxpayers. We're trying to avoid situations where there's a potential for a double penalty. We're trying to simplify it with irregular income. And we're trying to simplify the distinction between under and over 65. So that is what we're trying to achieve there. alcoholic beverages. We've had some fairly substantial court cases over the last few years about people trying to classify alcoholic beverages in different categories. And that is because the duty on the categories is not the same. So obviously what you're trying to do is reclassify your alcoholic beverages into a low duty category. What we also discovered was that some of those alcoholic beverages were arguably not being produced in line with the requirements of the Liquor Products Act. So what we're suggesting is that those liquor manufacturers need to come to SARS and say, this is how we produce the liquor, these are our materials we use to make it. You tell us which category it falls under. And so we get better control over where they fall, so we're collecting the right duty, and whilst we're doing that, we can also ensure that there's alignment with the requirements of the Liquor Product Act and working with the Department of Agriculture on that. Exchange information, this is going to be big news for you, I'm sure you've seen it. We're trying to exchange information across the board, especially in the income tax space, but as that happens in the customs space, we want to cooperate with other customs authorities around the world to make sure people aren't telling them one story and us another. So this is what this is aimed at doing. It's aimed at ensuring that we have a broader mechanism to exchange information, but once it's exchanged, we need to make sure it stays confidential, and so we also have confidentiality requirements that we're expanding. So we're expanding the reach and we're expanding the confidentiality. Four monthly back filing. I don't think there's too much to add to what it says on the slide there. Essentially, this is an obsolete concession that made other more modern concessions we made overtook it. We have only 100 people that are still in the system. It's taking up system space and complicating matters. Probably a good idea to get rid of it. This one is absolutely a SARS issue. You probably may have gotten an email claiming to be from SARS, and you've got a fantastic refund. If you just go to this website and fill in all your personal details, someone will steal them for you. We want to be able to move faster to close those down, so we're suggesting we need to improve SARS's protection over its name, so that people can't create these websites and then wait for us to go through a long process to shut them down. By the way, I've also mentioned this is intended to close down people who are trying to sell things like SARS bags and use the SARS logo on their adverts when SARS have nothing to do with what they're up to. And then the last one, which is pretty important, tax clearance certificates. You heard a lot about this from SARS over the... We're moving on the technology space. We've made previously some amendments to catch up with the technology. We've worked enough amendments to catch up with the technology. This is meant to do that. We want to modernize the legislation.
Thank you, members. Let me remind you, we have 5 minutes before 1:30, and I know that members said they want to be excused at 1:30, but maybe if they take your indulgence, probably we might have to take it 5 minutes more, but this is a very critical message that we have here. Can I then ask you to come over?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just switching over to the losses that all of the VAT relating in terms of supplies to farms. My information from the sector is that they're quite worried with regard to this on, of course, as you mentioned, with the cash flow, and also because they don't do it on a 2 monthly basis in terms of things working out, but they do it on a 6 monthly basis or perhaps on a yearly basis, and that impacts, you know, in terms of the loans and what they need to then take up with the banks and their turning trip, and it's just it puts a bit of strain on that. I hope that the consultation that you indicate that your sector is on track. The information that I have in terms of the 2 billion or 4 billion that you've lost is exceptional, and that the value that they have to terms of is about 100 billion. That's a very small number of offenders with regards to the income that you have from the industry, and I would just like to have more information with regards to that. Then also the interesting information with regards to the Davis Tax Committee. They released a report and still in consultation, but they proposed in terms of say 8%. If we, am I correct to assume that we might review the company's tax to 30% and then small business need to pay 28%? The difference is just minimal. I think very harsh on small businesses. Those are the areas that we need to have the necessary tax incentives to see that as they grow in terms of people. Doing small businesses and when employment should keep coming forward. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Any other comments, questions? Yes?
over time now was quite quick. I must say that it was even quicker than the Gauteng. You know, I come from Gauteng, so the quickest way to get from the airport to Rosebank and wherever rather than the Gauteng. May I understand, Chairperson, that the information which you have been given is quite valuable. I would like us to pay for a same or basically a proposal which came up that we need to give more time and do it in a sort of a workshop so that we go into detail with these matters, because it would have been a bit disappointing if the full range of your compliment is here and they did not give us information. I must say that I was quite impressed also by the matter of, I think it's the version with the DTI or whatever, to really try and work on matters, because this issue of entrepreneurs and funding and monitoring so that they succeed is something that's quite important. But Chairperson, we will look forward to a next session that's going to be longer and bigger, and we're going to give them the information. Thank you.
Thank you. Okay, thank you very much, Mother. You know, one thing that's from my side, I think the kind of response that we are bringing into our technology is very responsive to the current economic challenges that we have in South Africa. Though, obviously, we will always expect more, as you know. And I think one would have expected more, especially on the small business side. But there are just one or two things that I just need a clarity on my side. And I think that when you spoke about, when you were speaking about the small businesses, I think you spoke about the threshold of between 1 million to 2 million and wanted to know what happens with those businesses below that. I'm looking more at your, because I know that when we talk small businesses, sometimes we would like to think, I'm thinking about bread and breakfast, a small bread and breakfast and so forth, you know. And those people, they are a threshold of probably 500,000 or something like that. What is happening there? I just want to check what's going to happen in incentivizing those that are below the 1 million threshold. And the other thing that I also wanted you to get a clarity on was on the tax free savings account. I wasn't very clear here. Maybe if somebody could explain to me, were we talking about, I'm not sure whether the exemptions are only on the interest amount or it also includes the capital amount. I don't know. I just need clarity around it. I didn't get that particular one. Thank you.
Can I suggest, I think just the point we made, that I think the workshop is a good idea, because, you know, we are only dealing with the changes we can make. So let's say the question on small business that you asked, it helps that if there's a workshop we can talk about what are all the incentives applied to small business.
Okay.
So that then you get a comprehensive thing. What you're getting here from us is just the changes to the current system. And of course, added to that, there is the dealers commissioning papers from the businesses, because the state hub is the problem here. Okay. So, and I think, just the other thing that I would just like to get across, I think I have a question on impact response. And we want to have the confidence that we, and you need to check on us as well, and beat us up if we don't. And just as that issue, it's important for a particular sector in the economy. Quite important, I found that there are having meetings. We do hear some of it can be dealt with administratively, like funds, the new funds, and so on, but there may be an impact. Okay. Now, we don't have the time now to go into the detail, but as we engage, we will, especially when we come back and respond, even if we didn't have a workshop, we'll come back to you on those issues. And we often relax or change the time when these apply to try and deal with those problems. I think the issue on what I would suggest is we've taken a list of the questions, so perhaps as a first step we will respond in writing, so at least we've covered all the questions that members have asked. Okay? But if you have a workshop, we can do this much more comprehensively. And I think the point we want to just make with the committee is, you know, normally if we have a text presentation, even if we had 6 hours, wanted to alert you that these birds are there, they have to pass before the end of the year, otherwise you will spark a crisis, okay, and I'm not sure if I'm still going to do that, okay. So we do need to get the legislation at least pushed, okay. To the extent that the way forward, I think that it's quite important just that you have those hearings to allow the public and whoever, and there's a whole constituency out there that wants to come, and farmers will be here, everybody will be here. So you will hear from them directly. So I think what we're asking is if you can at least schedule the 2 days next month in August, because the longer you delay, it's going to make it almost impossible then to deliver all the birds in time.
Yeah.
And I'm staying very nice this year. I know it's heavy pressure on you, so I must apologize, but with the election, it does mean that the time has been later and a bit more constrained, perhaps, in terms of time.
Yeah, okay. No, I think we all appreciate the time constraints, and in fact, I wanted to propose to the members that we should consider maybe the end of October or beginning of September for public hearings. However, maybe in between that phase, I don't know how is it possible, because it's going to be important for us to have as much clarity as possible. I mean, you can't get people coming here for a year before and you don't have sufficient clarity on a number of issues. It's important, so obviously you are also going to be there with the appeal.
Yes, you know, in fact, firstly I want to say, I want to appeal to you that you have the hearings in the second or third week of August. And I take
the second or third week of August?
No, I'll tell you why.
Yeah.
Because what happens, I'm going into the normal process. What happens is that while the Freedom of Public Comments are out, you already hear from people. And that impacts on also when we can respond. So I'm saying, it would help, I think, with the committee chair, because we're going to have to work backwards.
Charles, hold on. I mean, I just need to, and let me just get clarity from you. Is it possible because I know there's a process, we have to have the time, we have to do this, we have to do that.
No, that's what I say. I think that if you can get the adverts out already and decide on the date, I think that
maybe we could, but the earliest I think we could do it is probably the third week of August.
Yes.
I think it might be the third week of August. Probably let's not push it to the third week of September. Maybe let's consider the third week of August. Is that fine? Okay.
Thank you, Jen.
You already presented. It was quite, it was so much to take in, but we really appreciate it. We understand the time constraints and also this being the election year. So it's not going to be normal. And probably going forward next year, I'm sure things will be slightly better than now. We understand that. And I think we are doing all this within the constraints that we find ourselves in. Anyway, members, I think I'm going to leave you, but let me invite all of you for a dinner lunch. We don't want to be guilty, not the standing committee, of wasteful and fruitless expenditure. Just outside, they eat food outside. Please remember, all of you, we are invited. Okay. Thank you.
The first week is a break, you rest. The Right now, the Pakistan is one of the people.